Award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. Peter and Jolene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Jolene.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everybody. Hi, Jolene.
Hello, Peter.
We got our numbers rolling. 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
And Athena sitting in that room all by herself. So give her a jingle. And this is a phone-in talk show. And if you've heard this for the first time, you know, this show's been is in its 42nd year.
Yeah.
So it's going on like half a century. But we still find people that say, wow, I didn't know Riff had a talk show.
I know. It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Isn't it amazing that we aren't the center of the universe?
We're not?
It's apparently not.
Hasn't our Facebook, I mean, I don't know if you're supposed to say this, you're always supposed to have like an up since, but hasn't our Facebook deal kind of been slowing a little?
We've been I'll be right back. We've been at a kind of,
plateau.
Plateau.
Okay.
I'll be right back. I got to go take care of something.
All right. And this, she's not going to the bathroom.
No.
I mean, it's okay if she did. Although I'd say, why didn't you do it before you got on the air? No, technical problem with Athena in, there's a separate room. And then what happens? The calls come in to 313-298-WRIF. And then Athena gets them and says, what do you want to talk about? And then, and where are you from? So then it's, you know, Jim from Ypsilanti wants to talk about this and that. Well, you know, there's some pretty weighty issues that we're facing in this era. And a lot of it comes up in these, what would you call it, in these individual issues. You know, like I'm even hesitant to mention the G word, right? It's a three-letter word. We talked a lot about it last time because, you know, people go pretty strong opinions about, you know, the G word. And the reason I'm saying that, I don't know, we all set?
Yeah.
You want to tell me what the problem is, or it is a technical thing that should not be mentioned?
I'm just saying whoever uses the studio before us needs to make sure they go back to the original computer screen. Thank you.
Yeah. Oh, you had. Yeah. But now Athena knows how to do it.
But it's, if she, yes, she does.
But she shouldn't have to.
She shouldn't have to.
She should.
Okay.
Because then when someone else comes to her and says, I can't get the right screen. You know, you can just switch between all these screens.
It's amazing.
This is so boring. Anyway, I was saying that there are all these single issues mm-hmm. that are whipping everybody up. Right?
Absolutely.
And I said
into a frenzy.
One of them is the G word, which I didn't even want to mention. Three-letter word. We talked a lot about it last.
It's four-letter word, really. I mean, it's, you know.
Oh, in the plural.
Yes. I mean, you know, that's usually what people say.
Oh, yeah. Mm-mm. Yeah. What?
Lethal weapons.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So the reason, and I'd like, but the core.
I thought you meant gay.
Oh, no.
We talk about that a lot, too.
Oh, yeah, we got some gay stuff going, too. But, so where was I? All right, so here's the deal. There's all these really crucial economic developments and things that are going to affect us really heavily over the span of our lifetime. And I don't care whether you're 70 or 17. Mm-hmm. This is a critical point, like it has been in other eras. The last one. You could make an argument for lots of different periods, but the last one, the most dramatic one, of course, was the 1930s. Mm-hmm. That's wedged most in our mind.
And tell people why. I mean, just a brief. Well, a lot of social change.
Yeah, occurred. That has to do with this class war that's going on. And this is, there was something that was called, I mentioned this once before, it's called the Great Compression. Not the Great Depression or Recession, but the Great Compression. And what it was a massive redistribution of income between like 1933 and the early 1970s, mm-hmm. you know. And what that meant was the reason that there was this wealth redistribution was because a middle class was formed that between unions demanding higher wages because of an expansion of the economy, the creation of jobs, and within that, the understanding that we had to have a consumer class that could buy a lot of the stuff that was being manufactured at this incredible rate. By the 1970s, the people that had fought that, the upper economic elite, the people that had fought the redistribution of income, because it essentially took wealth from them and spread it to the classes below, particularly the middle class.
Humane manner.
Yeah, yeah. It wasn't, you know, like Russia or any place like that. It was a peaceful revolution of not great proportions because wealth still controlled the system. Mm-hmm. There was a 1%, but the 99%
mattered.
Yeah, and it also wasn't sort of an undifferentiated 99%. There was this middle strata that we call the middle class, and some of what traditionally had been the working class was in that because you could have a union job, and hey, guess what? You could have a nice home. You could have maybe even a cottage, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
The big shots, the wealthy, decided we don't like this. I mean, why should we be paying people good wages?
When they can make their own way in life,
instead of paying good wages, they could pay much lower, which would mean much more money for them.
Yes, absolutely.
All right. So in the meantime, there's all these other social issues that come up, like abortion and contraception and guns and
hot button issues, gay marriage,
all of this, race, you know,
racism.
Stuff like that. Yeah,
yeah. You know what? As a matter of fact, I had the most odd thing happen to me before I came to the show today. I went down to the local 7-Eleven, you know, and I got totally hit on by a racist.
How do you know?
Because this dude had a car completely covered in Confederate flags. And I mean, covered. And including flags hanging off the back of him, flying. And then the front license plate, you know those mud flaps with the ladies kind of in there, you know. There was one of those, but she was a Confederate flag. Yeah. And so he hit on me, and I, in no other terms, told him, you know, your car is offensive. And I got in my car and sped away. Can you believe that? I am the wrong person to hit on if you have anything to do with the Confederate flag. He was creepy.
Well, I got to tell you, I've said this before. Some guy flying that flag shot my great-great-grandpappy.
Yes, that's
so
true.
I don't give that any slack whatsoever.
It's just a symbol of racism. There was this African-American family there, a man, woman, and a little girl. And I saw them. Their mouths just hung open when they saw this. And this guy was so crazy. He was leaving when I went in.
You sure this wasn't being videoed? It sounds like
no.
A, you know,
well,
like,
I'm sure it was by their security cameras. Yeah. But he was waiting outside for me, sitting there, not even in his car, just kind of leaning against the building. I'd been in there for a while too. You know, I like that store. And so he was sitting there smoking a cigarette, and he gave me tried talking to me, and I'm thinking, oh God, dude, you have no idea who you're talking to here.
And you're listening to Jalene Jordan. I'm Peter Werby. This is Night Call, WRIF's phone-in talk show. It's 313-298-WRIF, which, you know, is like the Confederate flag. It's another hot-button issue. I don't mean to say that it doesn't have relevance and that it doesn't connote lots of stuff that is very important. But at some point, we have to address what's happening to us economically.
Yep.
Because there is a massive shift of wealth in this country, all of which is going to the 1%, and particularly the 0.1% at the pinnacle of the social pyramid. And this is who George Romney speaks for. This is who George Romney is. And as we always say, it's, what? Did I say George again?
Again.
I don't know why.
Yeah. It's a mental block.
Yeah, yeah.
I swear.
Mitt happens.
Mitt does happen.
Yeah. You get that?
I get it.
Okay. Yeah, actually, that was a headline in a British newspaper.
It was
because he made all these gaffes.
Yeah, he over did there. Over in
yeah in England.
England.
Yeah, where was I? Anyway, these have to be addressed. I don't mean to say that we shouldn't address all these other issues as well, but let me. Oh man! All right. Let's talk about something positive just for a while. The Olympics, which are always fun. Did you see that opening ceremony?
No, but I did not, because I'm not really into the Olympics. Sorry if it's un-American, everybody, but it's just not my thing. And I don't watch TV, but I have a breakthrough. I have started watching a little bit again. This was a really cool ceremony, though. I read about it.
Right. It was, and it was spectacular in the true meaning of the word. But this is interesting. I mean, can these things ever be without politics? No. This is, a celebration here. Olympic opening ceremony grapples with weighty issues. Yeah. Healthcare. That's another one of the issues.
Yeah, and there was
a celebration of free healthcare, the trade union struggles, the battle for women's rights, and a fleeting lesbian kiss during the Olympics opening ceremony on Friday. And unsurprisingly, the show, devised by Oscar-winning British director Danny Boyle, drew accusations from the British political right that had strayed into lefty issues.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, like health care and getting good wages.
Oh,
why should that be left issues?
Lefty,
I don't get that.
Why does anyone think it's a bad thing?
Well, it's the
I'll
right.
Never get it.
The right want to.
They don't want their money.
Yeah. Aidan Burley, a lawmaker from Prime Minister David Cameron's ruling Conservative Party, tweeted, "The most lefty opening ceremony I've ever seen, more than Beijing, the capital of a communist state." He followed that with, "Thank God the athletes have arrived. Now we can move on from lefty multicultural crap." Well, who is this guy? It turns out that Burley was removed from his job as aide to the transport minister last month after attending a Nazi-themed stag party in a French ski resort.
He sure did.
I mean,
and this kind of thing exists.
Yeah. And you know what, folks? If you go to Europe, where is the biggest expression of fascism during the last century, the conservatives always back the fascists, without a doubt.
Absolutely.
And if you think, wow, the liberals were in the commies, the liberals.
Commies.
The liberals were always eliminated by the communists.
Well, see, there's that.
Yeah, yeah. So it's the opposite. So it turns out historically in Europe, fascists and conservatives were twins. And there was, by the way, in England, there was this great appreciation with different sectors of the British ruling class, the conservatives, with Hitler. I mean, it's a long story, but they were there. Anyway, let's see here. Alistair Campbell, on the other hand, former British Labour Prime Minister Tony Blair's communications chief, retorted on Twitter, "Brilliant that we got a socialist to do the opening ceremony." Rub it in, man.
I know.
Cameron's Downing Street office distanced itself from Burley's comments, and he just said, it was okay. But the show, bringing the curtain up on the London Olympics, began with section showing idyllic rural Britain being overtaken by the Industrial Revolution before moving on to a 10-minute sequence celebrating the state-run National Health Service.
Yeah, and then there was something with the nuclear disarmament. They formed that symbol.
The peace sign.
That one. I thought there was another nuke one, too.
No, that's the CND, the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament.
Yeah.
The peace sign that everybody knows.
Yeah.
Except a cake decorator, which I'll tell you in a second. But those are semaphore signals for CND, Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament.
Yeah, nice.
That was Bertrand Russell, a great British philosopher.
Something big coming up, I think, in D.C. with that.
Well, I would hope so.
Yeah.
Backed by popular demand, the peace symbol, right? There was whose birthday? I don't know. I mean, actually, you know what?
I think it was your
mine.
Birthday.
Yeah, it was mine. That's right. You were there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So my wife goes and, my real wife, not my radio wife, gets a cake made and said,
cheating on me.
Said it was my birthday, but it's also the 50th anniversary of the peace symbol. Well, maybe that one. I'm trying to put the correct date on it. Anyway, and so my wife says, you know what a peace symbol? Well, yeah, sure, I know what a peace symbol. So what
the
does it come?
The cake decorator.
The cake.
Back as
the Mercedes symbol.
Which is just so oxymoronish.
Yeah. Let's see. Other performers represented the struggle of trade union movements as well. So that
I was really surprised by all of this. I thought that is brilliant.
They also have running the streets 300 brand police. They're working to protect the advertising rights of major corporate Olympic sponsors, including McDonald's, Coca-Cola, BP, Oil, General Electric, Adidas, Dow Chemical, Procter & Gamble, and others.
The usuals.
Yeah. The special brand police will hit the streets wearing purple caps and tops and have the right to enter shops and offices near Olympic sites and bring court action with fines up to $31,000 for the misuse of words such as gold, silver, bronze, summer, sponsors, London.
Oh, my God. That is unbelievable.
Because only 42 companies have been licensed to associate themselves with the Olympics. Are you getting cold?
Yeah.
Yeah. I can tell, folks, but I won't say how.
Oh, Peter.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, back to the show.
Back to the show. Where were we? All right.
I'm actually freezing. Are you cold?
No.
Liz.
All right. I want to hold off on these calls about guns, all right? Remember what I was saying last week? Well, here, I'll start with the latest story, which is gun sales in Colorado have spiked since last week's massacre, according to the Denver Post. And you can see the mentality. Oh, my God, I can't even go to a theater.
They're going to take our guns.
Well, I think it's...
Is that what they think?
Well,
I don't know. They always think that.
I don't know what they think. Well, that is sort of a subset. But
they're going to protect themselves from crazy
people. They're going to protect themselves,
like
their family, and maybe they have what's called a Superman complex, which isn't the best... it isn't the worst thing in the world. You want to save people, right?
Sure.
And you visualize yourself, and being in that theater, this guy raises his... what was the gun again?
The AR-15,
and you pull out your whatever, you know, hold the gun to the side.
You mean my mace?
And then that's it. So,
right.
But background checks jumped more than 41% since that Friday shooting that left 12 dead and 58 injured. It's been insane, said Jake Myers, an employee at the Rocky Mountain Guns and Ammo store in Parker, Colorado. It says spikes in gun sales are not uncommon in the aftermath of mass shootings like the one in Colorado. Let's see. Says Greg Wolf, an Arizona gun shop owner, said when something like this happens, people get worried that the government is going to ban stuff. Well, I don't get it. If you think they're going to ban stuff, you figure you get it, and then, I mean, they've got your name. You know, you got to register. And if they were going to grab your guns, they would... grab that, too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so what happens? You know, apparently this copycat guy,
that was East Coast.
A Maryland cops arrested a heavily armed man who told his employer he was a joker and was going to blow everybody up. Police said they believe they thwarted a massacre. Let's see what he had. He had Neil Edwin Prescott had an arsenal of about 25 firearms at his residence, including semi-automatic rifles, shotguns, and handguns, and thousands of scopes and magazines and thousands of rounds of ammunition in 40 steel boxers.
And when the cops got there, he was wearing a shirt that said, with the writing, guns don't kill people, I do.
Yeah. And I suspect this is probably marketed that, you know, that he didn't make the shirt himself. And he told his employer, I am a joker, I'm going to load my guns and blow everybody up. So here is the problem, as we've said before, and don't call in on this yet, please. That, in fact, I'm going some places that are really going to surprise you. But
really?
the more guns among the population, the more you're going to have nuts with guns. Now, we said last week probably 99.9% of people use guns responsibly, but the larger the figure gets, the more the irresponsible use of
well,
it.
Well, it's just the percentage, you know.
Yeah.
It's just all math, it's statistics.
Yeah. And I doubt if anybody with a – in fact, it would be interesting to know that if anybody had a concealed weapon in that Colorado theater.
I know. We haven't really heard anything.
I was with a guy a good part of the week who actually owns 28 guns. And
really?
I said, do you ever carry? And he said, oh, yeah, no. And he put one in his pocket. I mean, we were the most idyllic situation imaginable. I don't want to go
into that. Yeah, but why did he?
I didn't ask him.
Okay.
You know, because usually what he said.
Does he listen to this show?
No.
Okay.
He's asleep.
Okay.
He's not even. I was somewhere else in the state.
Okay.
I know the answer. He said, I just want to be prepared. You know, I learned that in the Boy Scout. Always
get your pocket knife then.
Yeah, yeah.
And your rope.
Well, there is a guy, let's see, that writes on our Facebook page. And that's facebook.com/nightcall. Is that still up there? Ooh, it seems to have gone away.
Things move.
Oh, here it is. Yeah. David writes on our Facebook page, someone even comes at me in a wrong way, I will shoot my gun. I have my right to bear arms at all cost. I mean, it's such a weird mindset. I mean, that's what I understand.
Yeah, very paranoid.
Yeah.
Very paranoid and very aggressive.
Yeah, I go hither and yon. I go into Detroit a lot. I've even go into some inner city places.
Yeah.
And never occurs to me. I mean, I make an assessment and I think, is this going to be dangerous? And if it is, I have on some occasions and I say, I'm not going there.
Yeah.
And that's the way I deal with that. I would think too, and here, this gets to be what I want to get to, what I said was going a little different place, was that a more deadly machine that is in most of our daily lives is the automobile. We were talking about that mm-hmm. last week some. That let me see, I wrote something down here, I can't even, I see, yeah. That next day after the massacre in Colorado, 14 people died after a pickup truck jammed with 23 suspected illegal immigrants veered off a South Texas highway. And usually the people that are killed in automobile accidents is not that dramatic.
Yeah.
But remember what I said last week, that they know, and insurance companies prepare for how many people are going to be killed, how many tables, how many people are going to be injured, I mean, payouts, what kind of billions and billions of dollars of property damage is going to occur, to the point if you tried to introduce another machine that we knew was going to be that deadly and that destructive, we're talking about the automobile here, folks, it would never be allowed to be
manufactured.
So there is a difference, though. People correctly think, except for, you know, like all the suicides and all the accidents that occur regularly with guns, that they are wielded with malice, where deaths and injuries and property destruction with automobiles is thought to be a, quote, accident. I mean, but under some definitions, it's not an accident because we know it's going to happen. We don't know, you know, we don't know who it's going to happen to.
But accidents happen. It's not a saying for anything.
The one woman I know recently, I mean, I know probably every single one of us knows somebody who was in a bad accident.
Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely.
I'm willing to bet. Do you know anybody who was killed in a car accident? I do.
Well, I do.
Any time in your life. Okay.
Time ago.
Right. And I'm willing to bet almost everybody knows somebody certainly knows somebody who knows somebody who was killed in an accident.
Yes.
Almost everybody has been in a car accident.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Were you ever in one sober? I'm sorry.
Darth
I'm only kidding.
Vader!
I'm only kidding.
Wait a minute. Yep.
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 Okay.
I was. I gave up drinking and driving and back in '99.
Really?
Yeah.
I knew the man. In fact, you know the guy. He gave up. He got in so many drunk accidents. He told me he was giving it up. I said, "You're giving up drinking?" He said, "What? No,
I'm
no.
Give up driving."
Yeah, he did, and he did give up driving.
Yes.
He's sober now, though.
Right, he is.
I kind of forgot where I was going with all the. Oh no, so this is expected, and we don't know. I mean, I know what I was going to say. So I know one woman who was killed, and another woman who was crippled is crippled for life.
Yeah.
And both of them were completely, doing everything they were supposed to. I mean, the other people.
It was someone else who.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, we could leave here tonight. Some big old tankers take us out.
Oh, yeah. How
right.
quick that kind of thing
But,
happens.
You know, there are as many, I wouldn't say as many as possible, but there is an incredible number of controls on cars. I mean, you know, Sammy Hagar says, you know, I can't drive 55.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're on the highway, don't you find it difficult to keep it at 70? I do, at least, because I was
no,
going.
No, I don't.
Really?
I really am a law-abiding driver.
Well, so am I. I was driving the other day.
You're a good driver.
I know. I was driving the other day, and I look, and I said, I'm going 85, you know?
Well, you probably got distracted by some right-wing talk show or something.
No, I wasn't.
Or the blues.
But, you know, if you think technologically, everything that's been done as well. I mean, my car, you know, gives me all sorts of signals. There's somebody in my blind spot. You know, I got a thing, the little camera on the back. That's
you do.
Sort of backing
you've got all
into
that
something.
Fancy stuff.
Ding, ding, bing, bing. All that stuff. And, you know, full airbags. So so accidents have decreased and and they've gotten rid of three-lane highways. You ever go on those? They had
three-lane highways.
Yeah, you're supposed to go, you know, north and south on one. In the middle is for passing only.
Oh God!
Telegraph used to be like that, going down towards Toledo, and there's one up on Route 23.
Well, I can
going
see
to
why
Taos.
They don't have those anymore.
And as I said, there are limits on guns. You can't have fully automatic. That's interesting. Like people say, you know, the Second Amendment is absolute, but we cannot have fully automatic weapons.
Okay.
Go ahead, say something.
Well, I thought you did. Do you still want people to hold off on these?
Yeah, hold
off. These gun calls?
Yeah, sure. Although if people are doing it, it's okay. Hey, man.
Are you okay?
Yeah, I think
what
so.
What happened, Peter?
I don't know. I think how do you eat those candies and those chips? I do. I got one lodged in my throat.
I could eat a.
Give the phone numbers. Will you?
I could eat a pizza in here and not choke on it. 313-298-9743.
So as I said last week, we can't have a bazooka. We can't have a tank. So if it's absolute, why?
No, we decided we're gonna get a tank.
All right. Let's do this. We have some
call tank
callers waiting. I want to talk a little about our economic future, and if we don't do something, it ain't good. But give us a call, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Jalene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Hey, this is Mike Rowe talking with Jim Twitchell, a real live Ford senior master technician. Can the work save me money on gas, yes or no?
Yes. By making sure that your car is in optimal running condition, you save yourself fuel.
Save money on gas with the works. $29.95 or less after $10 mail-in rebate. Click on the banner ad now.
Can you think of one good reason why somebody wouldn't bring their Ford to you for the works fuel saver package?
Honestly, Mike, no.
Up to 5 quarts oil, taxes, diesel, and disposal fees extra. Claim based on EPA averages. See your participating Ford dealer for rebate details through 8/31/12.
In case you haven't heard, Esurance wants to save you money on car insurance. It's also longing to save you money, and wishing, and yearning, and thinking it might be a nice idea to save you money. That's because Esurance was built to save you money. You know, cash, or clams, or greenbacks, sawbucks, simoleons, bits, chips, or scratch. Whatever you call it, you just might save it. That's insurance for the modern world. Esurance. Now, backed by Allstate. Click or call.
Visit esurance.com or call 1-800-ESURANCE for a quote. Not available in all states. Savings may vary.
Everything that rocks. Worldwide. You're listening to WRIF.com.
Your life.
night call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, thank you very much. And if you're going to be up a little later, got some great, some absolutely great interviews. And
I'm looking forward to the one about Howard Zinn.
Yeah, Matthew Rothschild, who is the editor of the Progressive magazine, is talking about the late historian Howard Zinn. And this is this kind of thing. I don't know why I have to kind of apologize for this. That you're thinking, oh, boy, that's going to be interesting. A guy is going to talk about a dead historian. But it all has to do with how do we view this world and our place in it and what's going to happen. If we're going to be blindsided on everything like we were during the Bush recession, that didn't come out of nowhere. You know, people were complaining that since the initiation, the class war attack of Reaganomics that began with the election, the assault on the middle class and the working class and the poor, the attempt to return the wealth that had been redistributed to the classes below the ultra rich, these guys have been planning for a long time, and they carried it out, and right now they've got the ball. So it's what are we going to do? Are we just going to be these peasants with thatched roofs and say yes sir, thank you sir, or are we going to
fight it the whole way?
Yeah. Arthur Naiman, also, 9/11, the simple facts, why the official story can't possibly be true. This is a repeat show. In fact, in there you'll hear him say as we approach the 10th anniversary. Mm, actually, okay. It's the 11th. But, and I'm not
is
completely...
Is this kind of a conspiracy thing here?
Well, actually, he's calling for a new investigation that looks a little deeper into the 9/11 Commission report. But we'll see. All right, let's do this. Rather than making folks hang on for a long time when I give this whole deal about what our economic future is going to be, let's get Scott from Westland, Mike from Fenton, and Ryan from Warren on the air. And let's start with Ryan from Warren. Ryan, hi, it's Peter and Jalene. You're a police officer in Warren, are you?
Not in Warren, nope. I work for the Sheriff's Department.
Oh, okay. Hello. You're calling from Warren. Go ahead.
Yeah. My view on the whole gun control thing is relatively simple. I think a law-abiding citizen should be able to defend themselves with a firearm.
Okay.
I totally agree with you. No, a citizen should not have a fully automatic machine gun.
Thank you.
A bazooka, a tank. No, absolutely, absolutely not.
But what about an AR-15?
You know what? A lot of people I know that are civilians have those type weapons. And they are completely law-abiding citizens. They just like it for sport. Go out to the range, and have fun with it.
Well, here's the problem.
I get that. I'm
actually surprised, Ryan, because most police chiefs, knowing that their men could wind up facing one of those, usually are on the side of, wanting to not have civilians have those. Because here's the deal. If we have 99% compliance by law-abiding citizen, I mean, the 1%, in this case, the criminals, you don't want to be facing those guys, right?
Yeah, but the whole thing in America is this. We have a lot of legal things. Cocaine's illegal. If somebody wants to do cocaine, they can go to any street corner and buy cocaine illegally. It's going to be the same thing with guns. The only thing that's going to happen, a citizen's going to go and buy a weapon illegally, whether it be an AR, an AK, an SKS, whatever.
Yeah, but
I don't see a lot of white people going into the ghetto and, and shopping for guns.
There's all kinds of criminal enterprises that just run guns, illegal guns.
Yeah, that's true.
It happens, and that's what's going to happen. Now the law-abiding citizen isn't going to be able to, let's say they outlaw guns completely.
Well, we've stipulated that, first off, no one's calling for that. Secondly, it would be impossible. Thirdly, it'd be a political disaster. But, for a long time, there was a ban on sales of semi-automatic rifles.
But Bush lifted that, right?
Yeah, well, Bush let it expire.
Yeah.
And the Democrats, who didn't want to challenge it because they were afraid they would lose votes. But during that period, the possession of them dropped considerably because you just couldn't go to the gun store. If you wanted one, you had to be, go to nefarious ends. And the vast majority, I suspect, of people that went to nefarious ends to obtain them were criminals.
The more scarier weapon, everyone's talking about the AR-15, the .223 round. The more scary round to me personally is a 7.62x39, which is the AK-47 SKS round.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's more scary rip round to me because that'll go right through the bullet-resistant vest and out the other side.
Gosh.
That's a scary round to me.
That's scary.
But, Ryan, what do you think about this? My contention is, as I said, that the vast majority, the overwhelming majority of people that possess guns use them legally and harmlessly unless faced with an unfortunate situation. But you do have, say, I don't know, what is it? I mean, I have no idea, but out of my head, at the top of my head, 1%. The more people that, that get guns and the more people that have lethal, with multiple rounds and, the 1% that's going to use them badly expands, right? The absolute number.
I'm not against even doing psychological evaluations on people that would like to purchase those type of weapons. I'm not saying there shouldn't be some type of procedure if you would like to buy, any weapon. I'm not against that in one bit. I just, even before I was a police officer, I had my CPL. I carried a weapon when I was a civilian.
Why'd you do that? Like I say, I'm not opposed to carrying a weapon. I think a healthy organism defends itself almost reflexively. But, you really feel threatened, to the point where you feel you'd have to carry a gun. That's what I don't understand. I don't understand the mentality, to tell you the truth.
When I was a civilian at my old job that I worked at, I was robbed at gunpoint.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
There goes that, Peter.
I delivered appliances, and I got robbed at gunpoint. I had a gun put right to my head.
Mm.
So, after that point, I went and got my CPL.
That'll change someone a little bit, I can imagine.
Hey, Ryan, what did you lose? Well, let me just ask you one more thing.
Okay.
If you would have had a gun and you had a gun put to your head, you probably would have lost your money and your weapon.
It depends what the situation is.
Yeah, sure.
I personally, don't agree with that 100%. It's just how it's going to go down. I mean, if someone gets to jump on you, yeah, you're probably, the weapon's going to be useless. But if, let's say, that criminal, that assailant is planning on killing you, and he goes ahead and maybe takes a shot, misses, and now it's a gunfight, well, at least you have a means to defend yourself at that point. That's a scary thing. And when someone starts shooting at you, you may even take a round. You may get hit, but if you don't have a weapon, you don't have a firearm on you, you're good as dead.
Well, you know what? I was talking about how automobiles are even a more lethal machine than guns. And in a way, I feel, and I'm not trying to disparage anybody, because I was saying, I was with a guy all good part of this week that was armed in this idyllic situation where you would have thought you could run around with $50 bills, hanging out of your pocket or what have you. But, I mean, we should be wearing crash helmets and flame retardant suits while we're
just
driving.
Like
a NASCAR driver,
I just have one other point. On hold last week, and I wanted to talk about this. The guy that went in there, I mean, it was a horrible, horrible atrocity. But the guy, when I looked at it, I said, that guy was smart enough. He didn't need a firearm. That guy could have went in there with Molotov cocktails. He could have went in there with real poisonous gas. He could have went in there with pipe bombs, explosives. He could have taken out that whole theater.
Sure.
But he just chose to go in there with a firearm. I don't know why. Who knows why? But I was just thinking, this guy could have created a lot more mayhem and death by using other means. So,
Well, I agree. In fact, people have done that. All right, Ryan, do this. I'm going to, in fact, I forgot about something from last week, which I will read. But thank you. Stay safe as a police officer.
Yes.
And thank you for joining us. Appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF. Now I got to find this thing because I was talking about, I found one thing I was looking for. Yeah, Mike sent this in last week, and I was saying that there was even a more horrific slaughter.
Mass murder.
Mass murder, and it didn't have anything to do with guns, as Ryan said. It's called the Bath School Disaster. It happened in 1927 in Bath Township here in Michigan. And this whack job, he was the school board treasurer, Andy Kehoe, who was enraged about a property tax levied to fund the construction of the school building. So he took these bombs to this elementary school, killed 38 elementary school children, two teachers, four other adults, and himself, and injured at least 58 other people.
Mm.
So, yeah, I mean, it's very possible to
I was just astonished by that being in the 20s.
People, you know, people set out to do great harm to others, that is for sure. But this happens all the time. A Massachusetts man, this just happened today, shot two of his children, killing one of them and wounding the other before he turned the gun on himself and committed suicide. This is in Oxford, Massachusetts. His son.
How do you kill your own kids?
9 years old, survived after being shot in the head by his father.
God.
I mean, all right. Okay. Let's see. Okay, here is, we're going to go to Mike. Mike's in Fenton. Hey, Mike, you're on the air. Welcome.
How you doing, Julian and Peter?
Hi.
Hi, Mike.
Well, I wanted to talk about that Confederate flag, but that last call.
Wait. Do this for me, Mike. I kept saying I didn't want to revisit the whole gun thing, and then I brought it up.
Yes. So
well,
you
okay.
need to so do the, reap what you sow, Peter.
Do the Confederate flag. The sign of the greatest, the flag of the greatest traitors that have ever been present in the United States.
Okay, well, it's going to come around the corner here. It's like, I kind of look at that Confederate flag like this. We had George Bush's, this is Senior Bush, not the first President Bush. I hear that his father was a communist, and he was helping in World War II, helping the enemy.
No, they were fascists. Not communist, fascist. Look up Prescott Bush. Prescott Bush. Just put in Prescott Bush, fascists.
All right.
And he was part of the people charge of this, trying to plan this coup. This, you know, like they have in other countries against the Roosevelt government.
Okay.
It goes way back, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The
right.
evil.
And so look, this is what I'm thinking is, okay, so that's his grandfather, and then we have 9/11, okay, and this is what these guys were doing. This is where they come from. So I'm not going to believe that they didn't have something to do with that. And that Confederate flag, you know, it reminds me of the same kind of stuff that they were doing. I used to think the Confederate flag was cool until I got educated about what it really meant.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. And what we're referring to is this guy I ran into down the street at a store on my way into the to the show tonight, and he had Confederate flags all over. He was even wearing this vest with them all over it, you know?
Yeah. You know, the Pledge of Allegiance, which says, all of a sudden I was trying to remember the end. One nation, indivisible. That's why that was put in there. That was a direct reference. I mean, people, you know, when kids say it, they say one nation, invisible, and all of that. Indivisible means that it cannot be broken apart. And the traitors from the South that flew that battle flag, that almost took the lives of my great-great-grandfather and hundreds of thousands of other people, that flag is responsible. I mean, it represents the people that are responsible for the greatest numbers of battle death, in fact, of all the other wars combined. So, and it happened. People fly it now as a symbol of racism.
Yeah, so, and this guy, you know, he looked like he was part of the militia.
All right.
For sure.
Thanks, Mike. Appreciate your call.
Thanks,
all right.
Mike.
Let me do this. So let me just get this economic thing. All right.
Okay.
You know, I don't think a lot of us, and it's hard for me even, to even think about where am I going to be in 1 year? I mean, I'll probably have the same house, hopefully have the same job. But increasingly, the operative word there is hopefully.
Yeah.
That none of us have the kind of security. In Japan, they used to have what they called the Iron Rice Bowl. That meant when you worked for Toyota or Mitsubishi or something like that, you were guaranteed a job for life. It was built into the culture. All right? Now jobs are so tenuous all over the world, and the employers still have to have employees. And the reason that they moved to to Mexico and Central America and then to Asia, because
they can still have employees and make more of a profit.
Yeah, because they pay them considerably less. This is reversing the Great Compression, as I called it, where there was a great transfer of wealth during the 1930s through the 1970s that took the money from the top 1% and began to spread it to the classes below them, created a middle class out of the working class. I mean, there was always a middle class, but it was a very thin strata of administrators and small businessmen and what have you. But it got to the point, the good point, because of unions, because of all sorts of laws. It never was because of the kind-heartedness of the capitalists. They wanted mine, and whatever I can pay you, only thing I want to do is pay you enough to reproduce yourself and work you as much as it is physically possible. So in some industries in the 1890s, people were working 14 hours a day, 6 days a week. And I always mention child labor, all of that, you know, 8-9-year-old kids working in mills. And I said to somebody, if the capitalist would have had a heart, if it would have been a system that had compassion, none of this class warfare and, you know, the workers getting shot down in the street. People got shot down in the street because they wanted an 8-hour day. Hundreds of men, particularly, and some women, got murdered by sheriffs and police and Pinkerton detectives and company goons during the 19...
protesting?
Well, they wanted a union during the 1930s. In that decade, I think it was over 300 people were mostly shot by people protecting the company. And thousands wounded, you know, thousands and thousands beaten up by company goons.
That's amazing that it happened here. I mean, that's what happens down in South America.
Yeah. Well, it was just like that. It's like, and that's what's happening in all those places now, because places in Colombia where
Coca-Cola,
people trying to organize unions there get killed. So, but getting back to where are we going to be? It doesn't look real bright. It used to look bright. I mean, if you're in your teens, now 20s, even your 30s, ask somebody who's in their 40s to their, you know, to grandma and grandpa, you know, what their perception of what their life was going to be. And what it was an expanding opportunity to enrich one's life, and you know what, even more so, the generation after. In many cases, that's all, you know, a lot of you listening. And how many of you have that now? How many of you think you're looking forward to a guaranteed middle-class life because you went to school, you gained some skills, and you're going to get a great job that pays you well, that's going to have benefits, and you're going to
and longevity,
and then when you hit 65, you're going to have a great retirement. You know, I mean, if there's probably about 10% of you listening that think that. Well, what the hell happened? You know, all the money's here. You know, the wealthiest country in the world, and what it was that led by, beginning with the Reagan administration and the economics called Reaganomics, the rich people decided they were going to take back all the money that had been spread, the wealth that had been spread. Now, here, this is a couple of items. This is about Caterpillar, you know, who make those bulldozers and what have you. It says, this is in the New York Times, when it comes to dealing with labor unions, Caterpillar has long taken a stance as tough as the bulldozers and backhoes that they've burnished their global reputation. Be it two-tier wages, so you got, what they've done is beat down the union, so they've got two scales, or higher worker contributions for health insurance, the company has been a leader in devising new ways to cut labor costs, with other manufacturers often imitating its strategy. What does cut labor costs mean? Essentially what it means, pay workers less.
Mm-hmm.
Pay workers less. So if they have to pay a union worker $26 an hour, they get one return on the investment of that part of the manufacturing cost. If they can pay them $8 an hour or her, well, gee, all of a sudden, they have a great amount more. Well, people say, well, listen, geez, we're in a recession and what have you. But get this, despite earning a record almost $5 billion profit last year and projecting even better results for 2012, the company is insisting on a 6-year wage freeze and a pension freeze for most of the 780 production workers at its Joliet, Illinois factory. Caterpillar says it needs to keep its labor costs down to ensure its future competitiveness.
To ensure that they can make that, how many billions of dollars? I'm not buying my next bulldozer.
I'm not either. I'm boycotting those people. Here's the deal. If there was a expansion, given how profitable the company is, maybe they would only make like $4 billion.
Instead of
4.9 billion.
Maybe the CEOs could make a little less.
Oh, the CEO. The CEO of Caterpillar makes $15 million a year.
Of course he does.
Right. Let's see. Caterpillar, which has significantly raised its executives' compensation because of its strong profits, defended its demands, saying many unionized workers were paid well above market rates. Indeed. That's what unions do.
Yes. Yes, they do.
Yeah, what they want. Remember, when anybody says the free market, someone's going to be trying to lower your wages.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what used to happen. It was all the traffic would bear. Or here's another thing. I haven't mentioned this phrase in a long time. The real function of labor unions, of which I've been a member all of my broadcasting life.
Because you're lucky. You're lucky.
Yeah, indeed. And that's unfortunate that it's lucky. Is to defend the average selling price of labor.
Okay.
Dong. The function of unions is to defend the average selling price of labor. In other words,
a fair wage.
To boost it to what it could be and defend it. Because if the capitalists, the owners, the bosses set it, it's going to be set by the market. And if it wasn't for minimum wage, they'd be paying lots of people in this country $2.50 an hour.
Without blinking an eye.
So again, this is a system without a heart, without an iota of compassion. None of this would be necessary if from the beginning, however you document it, 17th century, 18th century, when capitalism, and particularly industrial capitalism, began to arise, that these guys said, hey, these are our community members. These are people that are our neighbors. And this is my good idea to do this woolen production or whatever, cotton gins or whatever the hell they were making, steel and all that. And they would say instead, let's see how much we can pay these people. But I want to still make a profit, and I want to live in a big house, and I want to have a big horse-drawn carriage and all that. Mm-hmm. But, man, these are my neighbors. I want to pay them the best I can. Then they wouldn't have needed all this. Then there wouldn't have been thousands of people that have been shot down. There wouldn't have been millions of workers whose lives were ruined by industrial capitalism and what they were subjected to in working conditions and, had their lives physically shortened. Who can work 12, 14 hours a day, 6 days a week and have a life? But that's what early industrial capitalism was all about. So it took unions. It took government regulations and all of that. All right. We will continue with this, but hey, Maurice is back with us.
Maurice!
Haven't heard from him in a long time. But Dominic and John, Steve and Brent, and also Scott. So you guys stay with us, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this. No longer will your voice be silenced. No longer will your opinion be marginalized. This means you. And you.
And me?
No, not you, dumbass. But those attractive people around you, they can now make their voices heard with the Rift's daily web poll.
Yeah!
Remember, citizens, your opinion matters. And expressing it to complete strangers over the internet is the most American thing you'll do all day. The Rift's daily web poll. Brought to you by Bastille Systems, the summer's ultimate truck accessory. Vote now. Now at WRIF.com.
Drive through McDonald's today and grab a totally loaded daily double. It's two beef patties with cheese, lettuce, tomato, mayo, and onions. And right now you can get it for just $1.89. The new daily double, part of the all-new extra value menu. So grab the daily double for $1.89 today. Now that's tasty value. McDonald's, I'm loving it.
You know that friend who's always coming up with the next big thing? Like pasta for cats? Yeah, him. If he tells you about a great idea for an online car insurance company that's built to save people money, tell him Esurance has been doing that since pretty much forever. But his idea to start a bro-tel, the fraternity-style hotel, is awesome. Not like insurance of the modern world awesome, but good. Esurance, now backed by Allstate.
Click or call.
Visit eSurance.com or call 1-800-ESURANCE for a quote. Not available in all states. Savings may vary.
Whose house is it? Whose house? Whose house?
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
The Riff. This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much. 1 hour down, one more to go. At 1 a.m., I'll have a couple of interesting interviews for you. One about the historian Howard Zinn, the other about 9/11. This guy does not believe the official version. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people don't. Yeah, if you would like to join us on email, it's calltalkyes@yahoo.com. and hey, join us on Facebook as well, facebook.com/nightcall. I think part of the problem, we have not been posting very much lately.
Yeah, I've been kind of having a summer.
Yeah. And
let's just put it that way.
And our pal Debbie in Northampton, Mass, she hasn't been posting much. So, guys, hit it.
What are we doing? We're just right. Debbie and I are having too much fun separately.
Yeah. So we're talking about what our economic future is going to be. And, you know, there was a song by Timbuktu 3, My Future's So Bright, I Have to Wear Shades.
Uh-huh.
I don't think anybody's singing that anymore. But we're talking about.
No, that's not true. The 1% are.
Yeah. You're right, and they're doing well. And the fact, for instance, that now that U.S. yeah, my tongue got in the way there. U.S. growth, that's growth. See, that was where it was. U.S. growth has fallen to only 1.5%, and the recovery seems kind of mired. And all the Republican, oh, great, yeah, all right, they're going to elect us, you know, and all that, and internet. Stocks are sliding just like in 2000.
Speaking of Republicans, I'm trying to get down to Tampa to protest the Republican National Convention, working on my plans. So fingers crossed I'm going to make that happen.
Okay.
To represent Team Night Call.
Anyway, we were talking about the future is now already, you know, that so many jobs have just been eroded that had previously been, for instance, like union jobs. Like, I'm trying to think of all of them, like meat packers and why can't I think of any more other than that? A lot of construction work that were all union jobs paying middle class wages. And by the way, all these companies were profitable. It's not like they were, oh, we're going out of business. They just figured, you know what? We can make a lot more money if we break the union and out in like Kansas get Somali immigrants in here, or in North Carolina in packing houses. I'll tell you, you know what we'll do? We'll get 1/3 African Americans, 1/3 Native Americans, and 1/3 Mexican immigrants. And they'll all fight each other, and we'll just work them for $8 an hour. Ah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, these guys are really, they stay up nights doing this. Anyway, so we're talking about Caterpillar, who's trying to break their unions, a strike in Joliet, Illinois. The CEO making $15 million a year. They've significantly raised their executive compensation, and they say they need to force down wages and compensation, you know, benefits and all that, because it says it needs to keep its labor costs down to ensure its future competitiveness. And they say also that they got to get it closer to the market. Saying many unionized workers were paid well above market rates. And what that means in Joliet, Illinois, is that people aren't getting paid very well. So some of these people are making like $26 an hour. They suggest that their wages are based on, as I said, local market conditions, which is another way to drive down wages. If anybody talks about the free market, they're talking about driving down your wages. And
it's one of those terms that sounds good.
Yeah. Richard Hurd, a professor of industrial relations at Cornell, said Caterpillar has been a leader in the past 20 years in taking a hard line against union. Last winter, Caterpillar locked out about 450 workers at its locomotive plant in London, Ontario, then closed the factory after the union rejected its demand to cut wages by 55%.
Oh, my God.
Can you imagine that? Someone coming in your life.
And you're not even making it as it is.
Yeah. In the mid-90s, the company vanquished the United Automobile Workers after a 17-month strike by 9,000 workers at eight factories. They just kind of stopped production and did all the rest of the production overseas. Let's see. The union says Caterpillar, the world's largest producer of earth-moving equipment, is in no way uncompetitive and should be sharing its prosperity with workers. What a bunch of communists. Yeah. Get this, too. Walmart. They've got 2.2 million workers worldwide. Workers complain about conditions. Most of the company's workers are paid a dollar or two above minimum wage and earn an annual income of roughly $17,000 a year. This is for full-time work. A study found that in Washington State, 23% of Walmart's 16,000 workers depended on Medicaid or the state-subsidized health plan. Walmart's 2012 Walmart Association Benefits Handbook gives detailed instructions to its employees on how to apply for Medicaid. Does anybody get what that means?
That is unreal.
You know what that means? You and I, through our tax dollars, are subsidizing Walmart.
Their employees.
Yeah. I mean,
they are so crooked to the core. Corrupt.
Do you get this? They pay people low wages, and which isn't even a living wage. And they say, okay, but here, you can get Medicaid because we're paying you so badly. Well, where does Medicaid come from? Who funds Medicaid? Well, you and me. And let's see, in addition to low pay, many workers have recently complained the company's begun to demand that workers take on increasingly strenuous workloads, a statement buttressed by a union-backed study which said Walmart has been engaging in company-wide understaffing, which calls a speed-up. In other words, you're doing more work for the same amount of pay. Rivaling its, this was in the Guardian of London. You didn't see this in the local papers. Rivaling its massive size is the incredible sophistication of Walmart's union avoidance tactics. Walmart examines prospective employees on their likeliness to participate in organized labor and closely monitors and conditions employees it hires to snub organizing activities before it starts. Well, it could be they're just damn frightened.
They've been
right?
at that for a while. And then the one case I always like to bring up is in Canada. They just close the store.
Close the store again. So this, you know, you're thinking, well, let me see. These people are ripping me off. They're making fortunes to the point where, I can't remember her name, one of the Walmart heirs who didn't work at all, she just said, I'm going to open up a big art gallery. I'm going to buy hundreds of millions of dollars of art.
Yeah, and hundreds of millions. Yeah, she's got it all in there.
And it's this beautiful facility. It's tasteful. The best architects put it together.
Of course.
And she was able to do it because they're paying their workers $17,000 a year. And you and I are subsidizing. I mean, we ought to get, actually, I was going to say we ought to get free admission to the art museum. But actually, she has so much money. Someone reminded me that.
It is free?
It is free.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, hey, she does have a heart, Peter.
Yeah. The spokesman for Walmart said, unions for years have tried to unionize Walmart associates, and time again, our associates, you know, you're not wage slaves, you're associates, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're not workers. The associates have rejected those overtures. I think the vast majority of our associates have a very rewarding experience with the company.
Oh, please.
But how about this? The company has a private jet to convey its mobile union avoidance team anywhere in the country upon detecting early organizing efforts.
Oh, this is not surprising at all.
This is class war, folks, and we're losing. We're losing badly. And you got to think about what your future is going to be, all right? Okay, let's go back to our phones. Boom, boom, shot me down. All right. Here's Brent in Auburn Hills. Hey, Brent, you're on the air. Welcome. Brent.
Greg?
Brent. Is your name Brent?
No, Greg.
Hi, Greg.
Hi, Greg. You're on the air.
How are you guys doing?
We're good.
We're awesome.
I tell you what, you know what? I wanted to talk about the open gun carry.
Yeah.
And I open carry. I carry a 9.
You carry a what?
A 9.
9 millimeter pistol?
Yeah.
Don't you think you make a lot of people feel uncomfortable?
No, because, you know, the way I feel about it is that nobody's going to mess with me.
Hey, let me ask you a question, the same one. Don't you feel you make a lot of people uncomfortable?
No.
Why you would
it makes me uncomfortable.
Well, I'll tell you what, Greg. If you walked into a place with a 9mm strapped to your waist, you'd make me feel uncomfortable.
Me
to the
too.
Point I would leave the premises.
I would too.
So you're making lots of people feel real uncomfortable. Why would anybody mess with you? Nobody messes with me. I'm sort of, what am I, about 5'10" and a half
yeah.
or something like that, kind of, you know, average looking and all that. I mean, why would
you're
anybody mess with you?
I'm sorry, but, you know, look at Colorado.
Well, wait a minute. Wait a minute.
What about it?
So you're just you just got a you know an,
this has been a good excuse for a lot of people.
A 14
right?
shot
or bad
gun just in case somebody starts opening fire in the movie theater you're at, huh?
Yeah. Okay. Soon.
Well, let me tell you what do you think would happen? You were in that movie theater, right? You've got your nine. He's got body armor on. And he's got a semi-automatic rifle, and all of a sudden, you pull your knife. Well, you know, you just, I guess you would have to have it hidden, because I don't think they allowed guns in the theater. But, and then...
Well, that's no fun, Peter.
So you shoot at him, and all of a sudden, you've brought attention to yourself. When you have no armor, he's got an AR-15, your ass is grass.
Okay, I'm a retired policeman officer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know what? I was shot at his mask because that's not bulletproof.
Well, I don't know. He had a mask on. I mean, I'll tell you, maybe if you were a police officer, you might have a little more cool head than the ordinary citizen who's never been in a situation when confronted like that. But let me tell you, I asked you a question saying, don't you think you'd make people feel uncomfortable?
He doesn't care.
Yeah. I don't think you don't care that you make other people feel uncomfortable, do you?
No.
Okay.
Yeah. I answered that for you. You didn't even need him to confirm it.
Adios, MF.
Enjoy.
Yeah. Right.
Have a good time with your big old gun.
Oh, my God. Here is Steve. Steve's in Hazel Park. Hey, Steve, you're on the air.
How you doing, buddy?
We're good. Can you turn your radio off?
Hey, nah, my radio's off in the background. Buddy.
Good, good. Go ahead. You're on the air.
All right, yeah. My radio's off in the background. I'm sitting out here and outside of my garage, listening to you guys, and...
But wait a minute. One of the things, I hope you are looking at the moon, because it is spectacular tonight, even though it's not full. Yeah.
I'm sitting out here having a cold cocktail.
Oh.
But, Julian, I love you, baby.
Well,
you're gorgeous, and...
Wow. Thank you.
He's been on our Facebook page.
You're one of my favorite people also, and Peter, same to you, man.
Well, thank you.
I mean,
I'm beautiful. Yeah.
You bring a lot of good topics to the Detroit area. I work in the transportation industry.
Yeah.
I haven't had a raise in 5 years, okay?
Oh, wow.
Mind you. Yet they hired a new CEO in my company for $1.5 million a year.
Wow.
And they're like, well, we can't give you a raise, but yet they can buy all new equipment and yet they cannot compensate none of the drivers.
Well, that
5 years.
And, you know, I think, Steve, that probably your story would be echoed by, pardon me, by any number of people, by probably, I was going to say dozens, hundreds, maybe thousands, because the 1% is reigning supreme now, and they figure, I'm not giving Steve a raise or anybody in the company. Why should I? You know, there's nothing they can do about it.
They're putting these freezes, like Caterpillar, was that?
Yeah, yeah, they put these freezes on.
You have there's a freeze on yours, but it's not official. It just exists.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for listening, Steve. I appreciate
it.
And we got to do something for sure. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Let's get one of our long-standing callers on. Maurice from Detroit. Maurice, where you been, buddy?
I've been working, Peter and Julian. How you doing?
Hello, Maurice. We miss you.
I miss you, too. I was giving some thinking about the economy. And the only way it could be fixed is you got to get it right where at the top at the bank. The government needs to put restrictions on the way the bank do their business.
Absolutely.
Only then economy will. make money. You know, they got it for us, the working class people, not to get ahead. That's done by design.
It is indeed, but Maurice, let me only correct you on one thing. The economy is making money. The banksters at the top, all these CEOs. Remember, if you were listening, I still have this right here. I wish it didn't have the top 200 chief executives of large public companies. This is listing them. And, you know, beginning with Apple, where Timothy D. Cook makes $378 million a year. Yes, $378 million a year. And the guy from Caterpillar, Douglas R. Olbermann, makes a paltry $14
million.
Aw. Yeah. So, so at the top third is doing okay. And, you know, if you're just a little below the top third, well, then it starts to fray as you go down the economic ladder. But, you know, I've always said this is going to wind up to be just like Mexico. Hey?
Hey, Peter.
Yeah.
I also own an AR-15. And, you know, you can own it, you know, people own weapons, use them for what they are. If they ban weapons, people still find a way to get them. So you can have everything in place. Person want a gun, go to shoot somebody, they're going to do it.
You have an AR-15?
Do you have it with you in the cab?
No, and an SKS.
And an SKS.
Okay.
I have a Glock 23.40 caliber and a SIG 229 40 caliber in the cab.
Maurice!
You're ready for
I'm
war.
I'm riding in your cab.
Yeah, cabbies. My father-in-law was a cabbie. It can be dangerous.
Yeah.
All right, Maurice. Thank you very much. Well, I mean, this is not untypical. As
hey,
I said,
if I drove a cab, I would probably even get a weapon.
Yeah. Well, as people may not have been listening earlier, but I spent some time last week with a friend of mine, and he told me I forgot what he said, 25, 27 guns. And I said, do you ever, and we were in this beautiful, idyllic scene, and, you know, his wife and my wife, we were there, and I said, do you ever carry? And he said, oh, yeah, I'm carrying right now. And he pulls out,
wow.
You know. Yeah. So, and
considering where you were, I think that's a little extreme.
Yeah, well, it was, and I didn't feel any safer because
I would feel less safe.
Cause, well, you know, that's kind of interesting because I felt it's not like I felt 100% safe. I felt zero threat from where we were and zero potential of threat.
Yeah.
And, you know, he brought it out. And at one point he was, his wife said something about, like learning to shoot. He said, here, you know, and she said she was having trouble pulling the trigger of some of his bigger, handguns. And he said, here, try this one. I'm going to take the magazine out.
Oh, okay.
And he pulled it out and she said, would you please, I don't want to deal with this right now. So all of a sudden I didn't think he was going to go nuts and plug us all I hope there's not an accident here. So I went from zero threat to, I don't know, 5%,
a little bit of anxiety.
I didn't need that. He didn't need that, you know. And people usually say, can you guarantee me my safety? No, of course not.
And you know, the good news is we don't see these open carry cats like the guy who called earlier very often.
I'll be right to you. Yeah,
the only other time I've seen that is at Arts Beats and Eats last year.
You actually saw the guys doing open chair?
There was a total D-bag hanging out. And, you know, he pulled his jacket back on purpose, and he was, like, puffing up and being all... It was just whatever, you know?
Well, you know, here's...
And I was working, and I had my station attire on, so I had to behave. And it wasn't in the name of the talk show. So
But
I didn't say anything. Yeah.
Okay. Let's see. John in Roseville. John, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You are on the air. Go ahead.
How you doing, guys?
We're good.
Good. Hi.
Hey, you have touched on so many different topics along the whole gamut. I originally called in just to clarify a couple of things on the assault weapons ban, which was associated with the Brady Bill.
This happens a lot. This happens every show, by the way. Yeah.
And AR-15s have been available. AK-47s have been available. There are certain criteria that were defined that determined whether a gun was an assault rifle and would be banned or not. And there's certain things like a pistol grip, a bayonet lug,
right,
a flash hider, a detachable box magazine. There's certain things that these are different features of the gun, and a gun could have, say, three of these, but it could not have all five of them. So what they did was they took the flash suppressor off, and so the barrel was not threaded to put a flash suppressor on, and they cut the bayonet lug off. And AR-15s and AK-47s and all of these weapons were available all through the Bradyville ban, excluding a couple of features, but it was the same exact gun.
Huh.
So it didn't change anything. They just called them sporter models, and you had pre-ban and post-ban, and what that did was it created a great market for people who had pre-ban guns that had the flash suppressors of the bayonet lugs. If somebody wanted one of those, they had to pay for it. So the people who had them, it drove the price of the pre-ban guns up. Now that the Brady Bill has expired, Now the prices have come back down on those weapons because they don't have pre-ban and post-ban guns.
Okay, you know what? I mean, I think the problem, as I said, if you assign like 1% of people misbehaving with guns, the more people, the larger number of people that have them, the 1% expands numerically. But we got to do something. Here, let me just read you something that I read last week. A study in the Journal of Trauma and Acute Care Surgery found that the gun murder rate in the U.S. is 20 times higher than the next 22 richest nations combined. Among the world's 23 wealthiest countries, 80% of all gun deaths are American deaths. 87% of all kids killed are American kids. So,
right.
What do we do?
What's going on there?
What do we do?
That are killing people are not the guns that are legally possessed and owned by law-abiding citizens.
My legal guns, I
own four AR-15s personally right now, and I'm just an average Joe. I enjoy building them, and I enjoy shooting them, target and hunting. I have several different calibers in the AR-15s.
You shoot animals with that thing?
That's okay.
Pardon me?
You shoot animals with that?
Well, I plan on going deer hunting this coming year with an AR-15.
What about an old-fashioned bow and arrow?
Oh, that's horrible.
Come on.
Well, it's not horrible.
I take that back. Go ahead. Sorry.
There's more deer that are wounded with bow and arrow.
That's what I was going to say.
And using a firearm is actually more humane because it's a quicker, more effective kill. So,
poor Bambi.
And there's
I take it back.
There's tons of deer. In fact, there's an overpopulation.
There is, I know.
And a woodchuck, and there's many different animals that people hunt. The AR-15 is an extremely accurate rifle.
For
a semi-automatic weapon, it shoots with sniper accuracy. It's a very accurate weapon. The AK-47 is not as accurate as a weapon. It does shoot a little bit larger of a bullet.
Hold on just a minute, John. You're not a problem. You know, my friend isn't a problem. I'm not a problem. You know, that's not the problem. The problems come up very infrequently. If you have 300 million guns, or is it 200 million, whatever, hundreds of millions of guns that we all own collectively, there's a percentage of people that are using them badly. Is there anything? I mean, last week we came to the conclusion that maybe we are represented by 80% of all gun deaths, 87% of all kids. But there's not much we can do. So I don't even know why the hell we're talking about. I just read about this guy that just shot his two kids and shot himself. You know,
And I bet he owned that gun legally.
Well, I bet he didn't do it. I bet he didn't do it with an AR-15, right?
No, he probably didn't. But, Peter, the one thing is, if you start talking about gun control, before anybody thinks about coming and asking for my legal guns that I own and they've never done anything illegal with, go collect all the illegal guns that are committing the crimes out there. But the thing is, you don't know where they are.
That's right.
Where my legal ones are, and that's where the problem lies.
Well, I don't think he thought that they were. The part of the problem is, is the lax reporting, exactly. And the fact that these gun manufacturers know for certain that great proportions of them are going to wind up in criminal hands in the United States, in Mexico, and other countries. These manufacturers that make guns that people like you use responsibly, use as a hobby, you know, with a couple of hobbies, you know, you say building them, possessing them, you know, using them for hunting and what have you. But there's a terrible dark side to this of these gun manufacturers who know absolutely. It's like, I mean, maybe you could compare it to the car manufacturers who know that cars are going to be used in these accidents. And they, you know, you can go buy bushels filled of guns in some states and take them to states that have much stricter laws. So what we ought to get is, how do we protect you? But how do we keep them out of the hands of people that are going to kill their kids, or they're going to go to the movie theaters and shoot everybody? I have no idea.
Well, you can't really do that. You can't make laws based on the small percentage of people who are mentally unstable.
Well, wait a minute. First off, there's a lot. You got to remember, a lot of gun deaths. Like, there's been, I think, 312. Gun deaths in Chicago this year already. And these aren't mentally unstable people. This is, gangs shooting one another and, what have you. So, I don't
know. Chicago.
What?
Chicago's got bans on handguns there.
I know. I mean, well, let me put it this way. Maybe we ought to just talk about, the economy, because when it comes to guns, I think that we're going to have to accept this high rate of murders with handguns compared to, you know, worldwide. And just like car accidents, we just hope we're not in the line of fire.
Yeah.
All right, John, thanks for that information. I appreciate it. Greatly appreciate it. Thank you. Here, you know, I got to stop saying, I've been doing that a lot.
Oh, it's all right.
Doesn't matter?
Nah. Just
are we on the air?
Do your thing.
All right. Here is Max. Max is in Novi. Hi, Max. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey Peter.
Yeah. Hi. What's up?
I was listening to the other caller, and I thought it was funny. He said you can't make a law based on, you know, a few crazy people, but we have the Patriot Act in place, and nobody seems to question that.
Well, how about this? If there were no laws against breaking and entering, would you go break into your neighbor's house? No, of course not.
Right.
Oh, wait a minute. You didn't, Max, you didn't answer.
You answered.
No, of course not. But,
right. Well, so we do what we do. Almost all of our laws are made for this this psychopathic, well, I mean, depending on the laws. But a lot of the laws are made to stop this psychopathic teeny minority among us, you know, people that would go 70 miles an hour down a residential street or break into people's homes or hurt or beat somebody up or, you know, or
the
rob
list
them.
Goes on and on.
Yeah, yeah. But go ahead.
I think the solution to the gun control problem is simple. You have to have a license to operate a motor vehicle. I think there is no process for weeding out people with mental defects like Jared Loughner. It's obvious just from, you know, looking at him in the face that he's like cuckoo.
Yeah.
And he was able to get a handgun. You know, what's the process for qualifying people for a firearm?
Well, there's Loughner.
You have to answer the right questions or answer the questions correctly. Yeah.
There's Loughner, and then there's this Holmes guy. But go to like Yahoo News, and there you've got this perfectly respectable father,
looking
guy that just shoots his kids and shoots himself. You know, I mean, probably because he's going to spite his old lady because she left him.
Oh my God! Yeah. I know someone who did that and also shot the family dog.
Damn! All right, thank you very much. Let's see. Here is Al. Al is in Bloomfield. Hey, Al, you're on the air.
Hi, Peter. First time caller. I listen to you all the time.
Well, thank
welcome.
You.
Thank you. What I wanted to say was, first of all, you said the guy had the AR-15 he had, I believe I read it was a Smith & Wesson, it jammed on the second shot. I believe.
Oh, well, he still managed to kill 12 people.
Well, no, that was easy. He pulled off the pistols then. But anyways, what I was saying with that, but wouldn't, even if it would have been four or five law-abiding citizens with guns in there, and they would have fired back for a second, maybe there wouldn't have been, you know what I mean?
We have said maybe. No,
well, I said maybe. The other thing is he had a lot of body armor on. And if you had a pistol and he either had, you know, this 40 caliber Glock or I don't think it jammed after the second shot, but it did jam, that you would have just become a target. And having four or five people shooting at him in a panic situation, I don't know. But
the Wild West.
Yeah, maybe, you know, you could make the argument that, and that's a big maybe some cool-headed person would have pulled out a gun and got him, like, just in that one vulnerable spot in his neck. Who knows? All right, thanks, Al. Appreciate it. Here's Scott in Westland. Scott, hi, you're on the... Wait, hold on one second.
We have open lines right now for the first time, really, in a while. So if you want to chime in on anything that we've talked about, 313-298-9743.
Let me say this, though. This is exactly what I'm talking about. It's easy to talk about guns, and it's difficult to talk about what I was talking about, our economic future.
Yep.
The fact that we are, all of us that are in the 99% are in the gun sights of the 1% to diminish our standard of living, to make sure that we have less wages, less benefits, less retirement, and that the upper 1% and the upper 10%, that they're going to be just doing just great. And when we, you know, if you would like poll American people and you say, do you think the economy is improving? They overwhelmingly say no. But if you go to the spots where the rich, come together, and it's just, you know, it's wonderful.
Oh, yeah.
Because, I mean, I keep saying this over and over again, but this is the wealthiest country in the world. So the wealth is here. The wealth is here. Who's got it? If you don't have it, and people like you don't have it, and tens of millions of people like you don't have it, it means somebody else has it, right?
Yeah.
It's not hiding. It's not waiting there to be claimed. It's not waiting there for you to get a college degree or to be retrained. It is in the possession of people right now. The wealth exists. The wealthiest country in the world, and people are working for Walmart for $17,000 a year, and you and I are supplementing their Medicaid, or essentially providing health insurance for them. You get that? In fact, that's a better way to put it. Walmart encourages their employees, their wage slaves, who they call associates, to apply for Medicaid, and that takes them off the hook. In a way, I mean...
That should be... against the law.
Well, in a way, it should be exactly what happens. No company should have to provide medical benefits.
Right.
It should be a national, universal health care like they have in every other country around what came to be called socialized medicine. Right. All right, let's see. We got some new callers. Patrick. Oh, wait a minute, Scott. I did say you were on there. Do I have time? Listen, let me put you back on hold, and I will get you right out of the box. Stay tuned.
Promise.
We got our last segment coming up, so grab those lines.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Thanks for rocking with the Riff online. This is WRIF.com. Everything that rocks worldwide. You're listening to WRIF.com. listening to Night Call, the Riff's award-winning talk show on 101 WRIN.
All right, thank you. Welcome back to our final segment. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan here with you at 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
Some open lines, finally, as well. And as promised, we're going to bring back Scott from Westland. Scott, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Pete. Hi, Jalene.
Hi, Scott.
Well, actually, tonight I think I've got a genuine news story for you, and it bewilders me that this seems to have been overlooked by the media. And I guess I'll start out this out as a question. Have you heard about recent amendments to the state of Michigan's landlord-tenant law that allows for
What's it allow for?
Finish.
Okay, well, basically, it allows for expedited eviction with 24 hours notice based on allegations of drug use. Now, this is short, and I'm actually paraphrasing this, but okay. Basically, it says this subdivision applies only if a formal police report has been filed alleging that the person has been engaged in illegal drug activity on the leased premises, which means that, okay, let me interpret this for you. That means that it doesn't even have to be true.
Right, sure.
Okay, an allegation is not a fact. And this bill was signed, I believe was signed by Governor Snyder. And I would love to say that this is a partisan issue, but believe it or not, and this is from Gretchen Whitmer's own office. Gretchen Whitmer, the leader of the Democratic minority in the Michigan Senate, she voted for it. And the only senator who was present at the time, Michigan State Senator who voted against it, was Bert Johnson. You know, but okay, so basically what this is about is presumption of innocence. Okay, basically, I believe it's in the Bill of Rights that you're innocent until proven guilty.
Yeah, I think this probably is unconstitutional on the face of it. I mean, how they can abrogate contracts based on allegations. And, you know, you wonder, what are these Republicans doing in Lansing with all the problems that the state has? I mean, how many people does this affect, and what kind of, who brings these things up to these nutballs? I don't know.
They sit around at night dreaming up this insanity.
But that is terrible, Scott. Thanks for bringing it to us. All right, thank you very much. I want to get this on before I get back to calls. Got Mike in Detroit and Patrick in Flint and Dominic in Taylor. And, whoa, Dominic, you've been waiting a long time. I'll get you on next. In Kabul, Afghanistan, the American diplomat most associated with the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan says that American policymakers need to learn the lessons of the recent past as they weigh military options for the future. And this is Ryan C. Crocker. He's the departing ambassador to Afghanistan, one of the preeminent American diplomats for the last 50 years. And he's been everywhere, Pakistan and Afghanistan and places like that. But here's what he says that we have to remember. And first off, remember the law of unintended consequences. You intend one thing, but a whole bunch of other stuff happens that you had no control over. Two, recognize the limits of the United States' actual capabilities. Like, he didn't say this, but I am running all around the world trying to intervene in everything. And he also says, understand that getting out of a conflict once you are in can often be dangerous and as destructive for the country as the original conflict. In other words, the United States essentially, you know, other NATO countries have destroyed Afghanistan.
Yeah, and it's never ending. There's no end in sight.
Yeah. Well, you know, they, but what, yeah,
but
they
a
say,
real end.
Well, they say they're getting the troops out. But for instance, the article continues, in Iraq, the dream of a peaceful and democratic ally in the Arab world is giving way to a renewal of violence and an authoritarian government that lists towards Iran. Well, it does more than list, you know, it actually is the, you know, the Shiite, same Shiites control Iran that control Iraq. And an authoritarian government. That's why people died in Iraq. You know, there's a bumper sticker, Bush lied, people died.
Mm-hmm.
Tens of thousands of people have died, Iraqis and Americans, many of you listening have suffered. And what is there now? The country is descending into violence again. There's this authoritarian government. Can you say Saddam Hussein? Remember him?
Yeah, absolutely.
In Afghanistan, the future is uncertain, hangs on dozens of ifs. If the elections are fair enough, if the Afghan security forces can fight off insurgents, if the government can become self-evident. So the retiring envoy to Afghanistan exhorts U.S. to look at the past. What are we doing? Our country doesn't matter in terms of military stuff, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat. Well, maybe. I don't even know. In a significant indication of where the Army anticipates it will be deployed over coming years and what it will be doing there, the service is planning to relocate some of its vast overseas stores of combat equipment and alter the contents of other warehouse stocks to reflect the changing nature of the mission after the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. You would think the lesson would be, let's get out of all those countries, right? No. A large number of MRAPs, the armored troop carriers built to withstand the blast of improvised explosives in Iraq and Afghanistan, will be stored in Italy where they can be transported for contingencies across Africa. Right? You ready?
Yeah.
You ready? How old are you guys? 17, 18, 19, 20, listening? Gonna join? Get ready for a war in Angola or Congo or anywhere. Nigeria.
Yeah, the military industrial complex is drooling for a new war.
Those could include disaster relief in hostile environments, civilian evacuations, or counterinsurgency assistance to local security forces. Including MRAPs could be sent to warehouses in the Western Pacific for potential use during a conflict in the Korean Peninsula. So there are contingency plans to fight another Korean War.
Oh, my God.
I mean, what would happen if North Korea, who is, you know, that, talk about La La Land and nutballs.
Completely out there.
Completely crazy, invaded South Korea again. Well, we would be there fighting a second Korean War. And if you can't really remember what happened, well, tens of thousands of Americans died. The United States killed about 1 million Korean civilians.
Yeah.
And, the plans call for the brigade-sized stock of armored fighting vehicles now stored in Europe to be brought home. That's good. A primary mission for the gear to be stored in Europe will be to supply multilateral training exercises among Americans and allied troops. So one of the places all the wealth is that we're talking about is here. We're going to be using part of our wealth besides
our tax dollars,
right? Beside that, that's our wealth funded by our tax dollars.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it, we're going to fund medical care for Walmart employees because they get paid so low, and the rest of it is for us to train troops from Estonia.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Estonia. Mm-hmm. Has anyone ever even heard of that?
Yeah. All right. Here is Dominic. Dominic, thanks for being so patient. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello. I got two quick comments, and then I'll hang up and go off air or whatever. But I got one. I want to know why you guys are so hung up on the fact that it's an AR-15.
Just because.
That's what was used.
That's what was used, yeah.
Okay, I was going to say, because there's plenty of other deer rifles that shoot a .223.
Sure.
And he just decided to spend $1,900 on a gun instead of $600.
Yeah, it was a one-time use in any event, and it jammed at some point.
The other thing was, you guys keep saying that he was wearing body armor. Last time I checked, they don't make body armor for your head.
He is.
Don't know if you've ever taken any of the CPL classes or any of the classes.
I've taken tons of them.
They tell you if you're going to shoot somebody, you're shooting to kill.
Right.
Because if you shoot somebody and you pull your gun, you're going to jail either way. And they say if you shoot somebody, the other person can't give their side of the story, whatever.
That's the George Zimmerman theory.
Well, they tell you in CPL class, if you're going to shoot someone, make sure they're dead.
No,
they can't. You can get sued if some guy's breaking into your house and you shoot him and he falls out the window and lives. He can actually sue you and your homeowner's insurance because you shot him.
Well,
what a happy little message.
just shoot him multiple times. All right, Dominic, thanks for waiting and being so patient. Why do I think that, a lot of people think about this stuff a lot. Anybody comes into my house, they cross that threshold. I'm shooting them so many times.
There's not one chance.
I'm prepared to do
that.
They will
breathe again.
I'm prepared to do that, but I never think about it.
No,
you know?
I don't want to think about it.
I live in a fairly low crime
yes,
area.
We do.
So Jalene does as well. And when we have a police officer come to our block club, she gives the stats and mostly it, you know, now they call it what used to be called like B&Es, breaking and entering. Mm-hmm. Now they call it home invasion, which sounds like some guy's running into your house with guns and what have you. But what usually happens, and 90% of the break-ins in our area, they're not break-ins. They're illegal entries because people left their windows open, people left their doors open. You know, they're in the back room watching television or downstairs with the washing machine. Someone comes in and steals the television. Are there horrific crimes possible and committed and all that? Sure.
Yes.
But
see them on the news.
I'm not going to spend a whole lot of my time
living in fear.
Or yeah.
You know, that's the one thing. I we've had some kind of scary things happen, but I refuse to live in fear. Yeah. I just refuse to do it.
Or if it's not fear, I mean, I don't know. I mean,
I guess it's good to be smart.
Most gun owners are pretty tough. But, I mean, fear is a, I don't know at what level. Fear means somebody is, like, quaking. But I guess having those kind of thoughts continually in your brain is...
Doesn't seem very healthy.
Doesn't seem like a good way to go.
Or peaceful.
I mean, some of these, like, people are all about, hunting and sport rifles. And John, wasn't he talking about constructing them himself?
Most of the people that we talk to on this show are those people.
Except for the open carry guy.
Yeah, well, he's got issues.
Don't you care that you make people feel uncomfortable?
No. Have a good day.
Here's Mike in Detroit. Mike, hi, you're on the air.
Hi.
Good.
Wondering why everybody's not realizing the money generators that we're making for our government here with the seatbelt laws. You know, now in Michigan, you don't even have to have a helmet on for a motorcycle.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, my mom drives a bus. Well, she drives a bus with 60 kids on it. None of them have seatbelts.
Well, we've talked about that.
Wait, yeah.
Those buses are designed to... bounce the kids around in a manner where they don't get hurt, supposedly.
Yeah. I mean, I was on a big bus, and it had seatbelts only in the front seats where you could go flying. If it hit something, you'd go flying right through one of those big windows. But I don't know. Go ahead.
Well, what about when they tip over sideways and stuff? I mean, you need to look up on YouTube or something all the accidents that happen with buses. They're not usually because kids bounce up in the air. It's because it gets tipped over on a side, and they get thrown all around.
I don't know. I mean, I'm not...
Well,
I don't know anything about one or the other.
My mom can drive a bus with 60 kids, or you can drive the city bus. How come you didn't stand up on the city bus and, fall down the aisle and break your neck? But you can't. My mother, the same mother, can't drive my son in her personal car in the back seat without a seatbelt. But she can drive 60 kids, including my grandson, her grandson, on the bus.
We have asked that question before.
Well, actually, Mike, that's very interesting that you can stand up on the bus, even. If one of those buses, those MDOT or DDOT or whatever the hell they are, hit somebody and everybody was standing, that would be really bad. But I was talking about the regulation of dangerous machinery, and I was talking about cars. And one of the things that has cut way down on accidents is mandatory seatbelts. Now, I mean, the problem with that is, I don't even know it's a problem. I mean, those laws were insisted upon by the insurance companies who wanted safer cars so they would have less payouts. And then there are also people, concerned about safety and what have you.
Yeah.
I mean, things like AAA go both ways. I mean, they're an insurance company, and they're also concerned with safety. But the less accidents people have and the less injuries people sustain, the less money do they have to pay out. So why there hasn't been a move say, hey, the bus is filled, every seat is taken, I don't know, because I've been on buses where you're just jammed in there, or a subway in New York.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
I will think about that. Thank you, Mike. Appreciate that. Let's see. Here is Patrick and Flint. Hi, Patrick. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Sure.
Calling regards to the 99%, I guess I'd be considered part of the 99%.
Mm-hmm.
But what I think is really going on is it's not so much class warfare as it's class envy. I worked in the shop. I was laid off, and I could have went home and collected 99 weeks of unemployment like everybody else. But instead, I picked myself up by my bootstraps, reinvented what I do, and now I have a much better job and I'm much happier. And I just think people...
Well, do you think everybody could do that?
I really do think they could, yes.
You know what? That is
statistically
not possible, Patrick. The jobs do not exist.
That's why you reinvent yourself. I didn't go out and get an average job like everybody else. I reinvented what I do for a living.
Everyone can do that.
Everybody can't do it. And listen, why should you have to have that that such effort? I mean, congratulations to you. I mean, that's really good. But average person, maybe you're above average. You have average, motivation. Maybe you have average intelligence. Above average intelligence. I know, I really didn't mean, I meant to say above average motivation, above average intelligence, above average skills, all of this. But what we should have to do is, they used to have this saying during the 1920s and all, the world doesn't owe you a living. Well, I say, yeah, it does. It doesn't mean it should give you anything, but people shouldn't have to go to these extraordinary efforts. Why in the world should you have to reinvent yourself? Or why should people be forced into the situation that in midlife, you're 50 years old or 25 years old, all of a sudden the rug gets yanked out from under you, you're doing your job just right, and because of these banksters in New York and around the world, because of these CEOs that are making $20 million a year and they decide to ship your job off to Asia, you've got to reinvent yourself. I'm glad you did, but the concept really sucks.
That's part of life. I mean, if you just stayed around and moped every day about, what happens, and just sit there and think about it all day, you're not going to get anything done.
Well, that's not what everybody does.
Yeah.
I know so many unemployed people who would be highly offended by your statements, my friend,
because
they are working their asses off to try to find a job, and they cannot find anything at all. So, you know what? Maybe try putting yourself in other people's shoes and looking outside of your own situation for once.
All right. Thank you, Patrick.
And congratulations. You got so lucky.
Yeah, for reinventing
yourself. Yeah, for reinventing.
You know what? If all of a sudden I got fired and there was nothing open for me in the
radio industry.
I don't know.
I know, Peter, that, I was out of radio for a couple of years. I was married, our show ended. I was living in Miami. I was absolutely lost.
Yeah. Well, let me see. What could I do? Newspapers. Newspapers.
You could write.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right, I could write. let's see. Here is, I can't read this very well. Nikki or Ricky? Ricky, is it in White Lake?
Yeah, I'm here. How's it going tonight, Peter?
It's going good. What's up?
You know, have I heard these NRA people talk about how that it would have just taken an armed guy with a cool head inside that movie theater out in Colorado
Yes.
Have these people really, that is just such complete and utter hogwash that I cannot believe that they would even say something like that. Do they even know the account of what happened out there? This guy had some kind of, flash grenades or smoke grenades or something that he used to disorient the people first.
Right.
And then he had like a 150-round drum and this gun, and he was just laying down the lead. The idea that, any of this NRA, I'm going to be a good gun-toting whatever and defend people. Well, how are you going to do that if you can't see from all the smoke that this guy has let loose in the theater? It's just crazy talk.
You know what? No one has brought that up.
Yeah, well, I mean, I did say that also, cool head. I don't know. I don't think, Ricky, that you have been, and I certainly haven't been, in a theater where all of a sudden, forgetting about, and I don't think you can, like a smoke grenade and everything goes off, but suddenly someone is shooting at you, and then you go, whoa, I better pull out my gun. And it's like I said, he had armor on, and
he had armor on. He had a 150-round drum, and I still even concede their argument up to that point. But the part where this guy had disoriented the moviegoers first, before he opened fire, you're not going to defend everybody there in that movie theater.
Well, you know what it is. As I said, it's sort of the Superman complex that a lot of these guys dream about taking out a perp, you know. So, you know, they start when no one's calling, somebody, you know, comes into my house. Or they're
going to be real.
Or they
dead.
Dream about some, you know, carjacker. If, you know, somebody takes their car, they're going to, you know, it happens, but, not usually. And I've kind of navigated through this life, and I'll bet you I've probably been in dicier situations than a lot of, suburban people have. And, you know, never occurred to me to need a firearm. At my side. In fact, what I've said is, in terms of being places, you know, if I was a bar owner or
a cab driver like Maurice,
or something like that, yeah, maybe I'd think that it would be prudent to. But if I needed, I'd be thinking like you know, the last caller. If I needed to carry a gun with me for my profession, other than a police officer.
You'd be thinking about a new profession?
I'd be thinking about reinventing myself.
Yeah. Let's reinvent.
All right, Ricky. Thank you very much.
Last call.
It's Mike from Clinton Township. Mike, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, how's it going? Listen, suspending the argument between left and right for just 1 second, you have to think about people, I mean, patented professionals in the industry, whether it's in the military or the police, they go through extensive training, undergo psychological screening almost to the invasive point, before they're qualified to operate and, you know, use firearms.
Sure.
I mean, doesn't it stand to reason at that point, since civilians are given free rein to have these things, except that they should undergo the same thing?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, and also to Flint, you know, not to demean him or anything like that, but you know, reinventing yourself is fine, but do you support social Darwinism at that point?
Hey, you know, Mike, during the 1930s, you heard the same thing. People would say, in the midst of the worst depression of, well, you know, actually some of the depressions of earlier 19th century were worse, but of this horrible depression, millions and millions of people out of work, and you know what these conservatives said? Anybody can get a job that really wants it, right in the middle of the depression. So the mantra
hogwash
is all
not
hogwash.
Those words.
No, that's what Ricky said.
I know, that's what he said.
Mike, thanks for being our last caller.
I'm going to reinvent myself.
Yeah.
I'm going to be more liberal.
I'm going to be a rocket science.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I'm going to be an astronaut.
I'm going to be, I don't know. Anyway, I got a couple of very interesting interviews coming up that I recorded previously. One about the historian. You know what? I actually said I was going to do the Howard Zinn first. But
yeah.
I think I'm going to do, because this will tickle everybody more, I'm going to do the 9/11 one first.
Okay.
This, by the way, was recorded about a year ago. So right at the beginning, I talk about the 10th anniversary coming up, and actually it's the 11th. So,
well, I have to be back at work in 8 hours, so I've got to go.
All right.
Did you know that?
You look good going.
Oh, thank you.
All right. Athena, thanks so much for doing the phones, and we'll do it all again next week. Ooh, here we go.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call. Right after this. Thanks for listening to 101 WRIF on the World Wide Web at WRIF.com.
Do you need cash right now for any reason? Then you need Matt's Jewelry Brokers. At Matt's, they pay top dollar for your used or broken gold, silver, and platinum jewelry, class rings, belt buckles, coins, flatware, and more. It's really that easy. Stop into one of Matt's 5 locations with your items and walk out with cold, hard cash.
Hi, I'm Matt. We've been family-owned and operated for 30 years and pride ourselves on honesty, integrity, and paying more than the superstores do for your broken or used items just lying around the house. If it's collecting dust, we'll buy it. If it's broken, we'll buy it. If you don't want it, we'll buy it. So before you go anywhere else, stop by one of my 5 locations. In Macomb at 21 Mile and Romeo Plank, in Troy at Square Lake and Rochester Road, or my pawn shop in Southfield at 10 Mile and Greenfield. We're also in the Meyer in Clinton Township and Lennox. Check us out online at MattsJewelryBrokers.com or call us at 586-286-2866. That's 586-286-2866. When you need cash fast, go to Matt's.
Who's back?
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Oh, who's the star?
Everything that rocks. Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Coming up soon is the 10th anniversary of 9/11, that date that's pretty much seared in all of our memories, the kind of event that happens in different generations where everyone alive remembers exactly where they were. All the tributes to the first responders, the sadness of the memories of the people that lost their lives, that's going to be with us on probably every radio station, every television station, every cable network, to be sure, and deservedly so. But there's, as with every story, more to it. And there are people that challenge the idea that it was simply an act of the 19 men on board the airplane that hit it and took it down. It always seemed to me to be absolutely astounding that this plane could have done so much damage. But there's a book just came my way. It's called 9/11, The Simple Facts, Why the Official Story Can't Possibly Be True. It's written by Arthur Naiman, and Arthur Naiman, the author, has co-authored and edited or published more than 30 books, and his books have sold millions of copies. We're reaching him at his office in Tucson, Arizona. Arthur Naiman, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Hi, Peter.
And this series, the Real Story series, you've got lots of books in there, and I've interviewed any number of authors about the Kennedy assassination, actually the assassinations of the 1960s, where all of which challenge the official versions, all of which I agree with. And you know that phrase, you know, don't confuse me with the facts. I haven't bought all of this yet, so we can talk about this and I'll see how I am on the other end. Why can't the official story of 9/11 possibly be true?
Well, it's kind of interesting. People assume that there is some technical debate about it, but actually when you look at the official story, it's completely obvious to anybody, if you actually look at the facts, that it couldn't possibly happen. I'll give you a real simple example. If you look at the cover of the book, which sure, your listeners can't, of course, although you can go online and just Google South Tower collapse, and you'll see the same thing as I put on the cover of the book. The official story says that, just to make it as simple as possible, not be technical at all, that the planes damaged the building, and they set fires that damaged the building more, and as a result of that damage, the buildings collapsed due to gravity. And the way it happened is there's a place where the plane hit, that's the impact zone, and there's a part of the building above and below it. And the only part that was damaged was the impact zone. So the official story is that the top of the buildings, the Twin Towers, fell on the bottom of the buildings.
Right.
If you look at the picture on the cover of the book, you can see that in the case of the South Tower, the top of the building is not falling on the bottom of the building. It's falling off.
Yeah.
At an angle of 22 degrees, as it happens, halfway to 45 degrees. There's no way it's falling on the bottom of the building. It's toppling off. So,
did it topple off? In fact?
Well, it began to topple off, and then it's all covered with smoke. You can't see anything, but okay, if you can see in that picture, or if you Google it, you'll see real clearly, if you get one from the right angle, that the top of the building is falling off. Now, there's two problems with that. One is there's no top of the building. It's 26 stories in the case of the South Tower. There's no 26-story chunk of building on the ground next to the building. And more to the point, how could it crush the bottom of the building if it didn't land on it?
Well, all right. My skepticism is challenged there to begin with. That's the first thing. Well, remind us of the damage, Arthur Naiman, because it always struck me, wait a minute, this one tower got hit and then all these other buildings collapsed? What in the world was going on? Remind us of the damage, if you would.
Yeah, you know, I had the same reaction you did when I saw the building. I said, those planes couldn't have done that, you know, because it looked completely unreal. The things telescope into themselves. Each of the Twin Towers has 80,000 tons of structural steel, and it was like there was nothing there. They fell to the ground free fall speed. So the damage, the plane, you know, first of all, the people who designed the building say that if you had taken out one whole side and the corners and part of the other two sides, they would have still stood up to 100-mile-an-hour wind. So the damage was, you know, relevant. It's not minor, but there's no way that it would have brought the buildings down. And the fires couldn't because none of them were hot enough to melt steel. So the damage of the planes, they were putting out black smoke, as anybody knows. When a fire is putting out black smoke, it's starved for oxygen. It's, you know, there were other buildings that were engulfed in flames from top to bottom, bright orange flames. There was a skyscraper, a hotel in Beijing. There was a another skyscraper in Caracas. Top to bottom, 17 hours and 18 hours they burned, bright orange flames, and they all stood. The steel wouldn't have melted. So and if you had taken out, completely taken out where the planes hit, if the planes had gone right through the building and cut off every column, they still wouldn't have fallen down because the tops of the buildings are lighter than the bottoms, of course, because the bottom has to hold up the top, and the top doesn't have to do that. And in the book, I have comparisons of the columns. They're much lighter on the top. So even if the planes had completely severed the buildings at the impact zone, which, of course, they didn't do, the top of the building falling on the bottom of it would not have brought it down.
Now, Arthur Damon, you had technical consultants, tens of thousands of members of architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, people that, as you do in your book, 9/11, The Simple Facts, dispute the official story. The World Trade Center towers were designed by a Detroit firm and led by Minoru Yamasaki. People here in Detroit are familiar with a lot of the buildings he's done in our town. What do they say about all of this? It's occurred to me. I've never heard much comment from them.
Yeah, I'm not sure what they say, but I'll tell you that when the buildings were built, they received awards for their technical expertise. They're extraordinarily strong. And there's one guy who says that, I can find it in the book in a second, but anyway, he says that it could have been hit by multiple planes. It's like a screen, like the screen on your screen door in your house. If you push a pencil through part of it, you're not going to destroy the screen. And that's how these buildings were built. They have 47 massive columns in the center and 240 columns on the outside, and there's just no way that a plane would bring them down.
Now, how did there were these other buildings, though, that fell as well, right? A plane hit each tower.
Well, yes, but there's Building 7, which everybody forgets about. There's a third building that came down.
That's what I meant. So how did that come down?
Well, there's only one way any of these buildings came down, which was by controlled demolition. There's absolutely no other explanation.
Okay.
It begins to explain it.
Now, at some point in here, it says this is no theory. I mean, that is, this is not a conspiracy theory.
No.
So the control, why isn't it? I mean, it would certainly involve a conspiracy.
Any theory about what happened on 9/11 has to be a conspiracy theory because it has to involve a conspiracy because one person can't hijack four planes, right?
Right.
So the official story is a conspiracy theory too. But what I say in my book is, I don't talk at all about who did what. I don't speculate about, you know, who might have been involved or whatever. We just talk about why the official story can't possibly be true.
Wait a minute, it's odd how, you know, just a lot of this, you think this is so, as I said, seared in your memory. You said four planes? Wasn't there three planes?
There were four planes.
You're right. You're right.
Twin Towers and the one that was shot down.
Pennsylvania and...
Pentagon.
Wait a minute. Shot down?
Oh, absolutely.
The one in Pennsylvania.
There's all kinds of witnesses to that. But also the debris field was covered 8 miles. And the official story is that the wind blew, for example, 2,000 feet from where the plane landed is one of the engines. And people say, well, the wind might have blown it. The thing weighs a ton. You know, the wind didn't blow it. And there's debris 8 miles away, scattered over a whole range of debris fields that cover 8 miles. So, and people saw rockets, heard other planes, and so on.
What do you think about what I've heard when it was realized that these planes were hijacked and they were heading back towards New York, that they could have actually scrambled U.S. jets to take those out, and they were told to stand down?
Yeah, I mean, it's not just could have, they should have. And, you know, what those planes, that's, first of all, they, if you wanted to take down the Twin Towers or any other buildings, you would have flown out of New York airports. They flew out of Boston. And the one in Pennsylvania, if it flew all the way out to Pennsylvania, turned around and was starting to come back. So why would you do that? And one plane was in the air for an hour and a half, one for an hour and 20 minutes. Even the Twin Tower planes were in the air for way longer than it should have taken them to scramble those jets. And look at the Pentagon, the most well-defended building in the world. How could you possibly fly into that airspace? Andrews Air Force Base is 11 miles from the Pentagon, and they didn't scramble any jets until the Pentagon was hit, even though the Twin Towers had collapsed long before that the plane hit the Pentagon.
So what do we make of that? I mean, it could be just bureaucratic incompetence.
it would be colossally incompetent.
Yeah.
There's nothing like it. It's unheard of. You know, they're supposed to scramble those planes instantly.
Well, Arthur Neyman, and let me just reintroduce you. Arthur Neyman has written the book with Greg Roberts and the architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth. For technical help, the book 9/11: The Simple Facts, Why the Official Story Can't Possibly Be True. And we were talking about the collapse of the Twin Towers, how they're, you can see on the cover of this book, the top beginning to fall at a 22-degree angle, so it didn't fall directly down on the rest of it. So, Arthur Neyman has told us that he's not pointing any fingers. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, no, we don't talk about that at all.
Well, here is, Mark Lane, who wrote the first material about the Kennedy assassination and challenging the official story, was actually the assemblyman, the state assemblyman in New York City of my mother and father. So I really got kind of tuned into that fairly early. And to this day, I don't think that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone assassin. I don't think I'm alone in that. Yet sometimes when people begin stringing out theories about who did what, and I realized in some of them, it would have taken a couple hundred people. Now, wouldn't this have had to be a conspiracy in the real precise sense of the term, of such magnitude, of hundreds and hundreds of people to put demolitions in the buildings to get these guys to fly? I mean, it just doesn't seem like it would hold.
Well, it doesn't actually take that many people because, to place explosives is not that hard. You have months to do it. And if you think about it, if you work in an office building, if I walked out of my hall and I saw some blue-collar workers up in the above the drop ceiling, doing something, or actually, in the case of the World Towers, the largest elevator renovation in history took place in the months before 9/11. And so it would not have been hard at all to get it wouldn't require that many people, dozens really, to play, or not even dozens, maybe a dozen to place the explosives. And people forget, take the Manhattan Project. It employed at a height 130,000 people for 3 years. And the intelligence services of the second and third most powerful and technologically advanced countries in the world, Germany and Japan, were trying their damnedest to find out what that project was about, and they never did. That's 3 years, 130,000 people. That was kept secret. Even in Santa Fe, right next to Los Alamos, where the people who went to work there would come to Santa Fe and then they would be trucked up to Los Alamos, people didn't really, they knew something was going on, but they didn't know what it was. And there's an even better example, Operation Gladio. At the end of the Second World War, the Western powers, mostly the U.S., because France and Britain were pretty wrecked, supported armies in the Eastern Bloc attempting to overthrow basically Nazis or neo-Nazis, attempting to overthrow those governments. We supplied, we airdropped supplies and food and armaments to these armies for years. And in Italy, where that's Operation Gladio technically only applies to Italy, they were blowing up train stations, blaming it on the communists, and this went on for 30 years. And that was many more people than would have been needed to do this.
Now, there has always been the question, particularly the people that first brought up the whole 9/11 truth demands, that this was somehow launched by the Bush administration in order to galvanize the people around him and to set the basis for wars in Iraq and in Afghanistan, which to me, occurs to me on the face of it. No, tell me I'm wrong, Arthur Neyman. No administration would risk what was entailed, that. I mean, the United States has lied about wars all throughout its history, as all governments do, of course, but to foster an attack on its own citizens and territories, that seems way beyond the realm of possibility.
It does seem incredible. I agree. But first of all, again, the book focuses just on the fact that the official story of what happened can't possibly be true. And all I'm calling for, and all architects and engineers and those more than 1,500 architects with 25,000 years of professional experience are calling for is a new, thorough, independent investigation. So we're not saying, we don't know. I don't know what happened. But I'll give you another example. more people have probably died from inhaling the fumes, you know, the first responders and firemen and demolition people, than were killed in the attacks themselves. And that was because Christine Todd Whitman, who was Bush's EPA director, said that it was perfectly safe to breathe those fumes, and people wouldn't wear their respirators when they were there. Bush didn't, she didn't. So they assured everybody it was safe. And as a result of that, this is just one hack politician lying to the public. More people died in those attacks. So there's a perfectly obvious example of the government killing more people than the attacks would have.
In your book, 9/11, The Simple Facts, Why the Official Story Can't Possibly Be True, you do have a chapter, and all your chapters, this is, by the way, folks, this book is with the index, 110 pages, and it's typical of these, the Real Story series that Arthur Naiman publishes, and Softskull Press, that's you?
I used to publish them myself, and now Softskull is publishing them. I'm just editing them and,
okay,
in this case, writing them.
And you can go to Amazon.com. You can probably go to Softskull.com, and I'll have a link on my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, and I'll have a link to this as well. But you do talk a little about who could possibly benefit, taking away the political benefits, which I'm going to assume on the face of it isn't the case. Who else would, in fact, and what do you cover in that chapter?
There's no question. Nobody disagrees that the Bush administration and lots of people jumped on it. And whatever happened, they certainly used it to their own advantage. They passed the Patriot Act, which could have never gotten through. It was sitting in a drawer somewhere. It's like thousands of pages long. They didn't write it after 9/11. They were waiting for an opportunity to push it through. It went right through. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan could have never happened without this. But also, there's a perfectly straightforward way which people benefit. All these defense contractors like Halliburton, Dick Cheney's company, and all these others there's $9 billion missing, forgetting about the trillions of dollars that were spent, you know, which they made lots of profits. They can't even account for $9 billion.
Well, maybe.
Lots of people benefited.
Maybe we just went over, although we talked about it a little, the idea that, in fact, that these buildings collapse because people put explosives in there. In fact, I've seen videos of what people state. You can visually see that there are controlled explosions as the building collapses downward, the Twin Towers. You can see flashes at each floor.
Mm-hmm.
And many people contend that that is the, you know, at least part of the visual evidence that that happens. But in your book, 9/11, The Simple Facts, do you treat the hijackers and the role that they had in it? Are they directly connected to it?
You know, that's another thing that's completely unclear. And again, we're just asking for an investigation to figure it out. There are cameras. There weren't at Logan, which is where two of the planes took off, but at Dulles and at Newark, there are video cameras in the departure lounges, and the government has not released any of those videos to show that the hijackers got on the plane. There's no evidence whatever that any of those 19 people boarded any of the four planes.
Oh, so you're saying it's possible, and again, this would have to be investigated thoroughly, that it's possible that the people that are identified, I can't think of his name.
Muhammad Atta.
That those may not even have been men on the plane?
Yeah, there's no evidence whatever that any of those people boarded any of the planes.
What do you think about the Pentagon? I've seen some pretty convincing photos. People say that it wasn't this big jet that hit it, but rather was more consistent with a missile.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. That's one of the few things that people debate a lot about. Most people agree about everything in this field. And I don't know. You know, my technical consultants think that a plane did hit it. But in any case, there's all kinds of questions, whether it was a plane or a missile. This is the most highly defended airspace in the world. How do you fly 11 miles away? You've got these fighter jets ready to scramble. They're not scrambled. They're pulling the sails in. It also made an incredible turn. It was coming in where it would have hit the side of the Pentagon where the top brass had their offices, and it made this incredible turn and swooped in at 500 miles an hour, there are a lot of pilots who doubt the story, too. There's an organization of pilots for 9/11 Truth, and they say that you can't, nobody could do this, much less the guy who was supposed to have done it was such a bad student at flight school that his instructor wouldn't lend him a single-engine plane. And here he is making this 500-mile-hour sweeping, diving turn and smashing into the side of the Pentagon where very few people worked, and which had just been reinforced, had been renovated and strengthened. So the whole thing makes no sense at all.
What are the implications of not going any further with this? That is to say that we're all united as a country in our grief about all of this. There's been a lot of examinations of the kind of the political fallout of it. People debate about the necessity of the Patriot Act, certainly Bush's wars and what have you. But if we were just to let this lay or lie, I never can remember. But why go forward on this?
Well, it's a major crime. I mean, thousands of people died that day, and again, many thousands more just from inhaling the fumes, and then hundreds of thousands of people have died as a result of the wars that we never would have entered if we hadn't, or started if we hadn't, if it hadn't been for 9/11. So anybody can answer this question themselves. It doesn't depend on people in the 9/11 truth movement. You know, you murder, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, and they say, oh, I don't know, I don't care who did it. I don't care what happened.
Is this getting any political traction outside of the circles that are the most concerned about it?
Yeah, Mike, I don't know how you pronounce his name, Gravel or Gravel. He used to be senator from Alaska.
Oh, yeah.
Is calling for, he figures the federal government's hopeless, so he's calling for states to start an investigation, and he's got a whole movement. And if you look in the book, I list, there are tens of thousands of people, as you mentioned, who doubt the story, but I list, several dozen of them. So there are lots of people, including, I'm blocking his name, the senator from Georgia who's a quadriplegic.
I'll block with you. I can't think of it either, but yeah.
Yeah, I should open my book. But anyway, yes, there are lots of politicians who doubt the official story, but of course, most don't.
Yeah, it seems so politically freighted that a lot of times you get a public expression of a politician as opposed to their personal, beliefs. You do actually list the actors, directors, and musicians, broadcasters and reporters, historians, academics. This is fairly notable. You know, one of the things that I think happened with the Kennedy assassination is that it got sort of isolated into a conspiracy ghetto, and in many ways got crazier and crazier, as opposed to, I think Mark Lane and some of those early people about the Kennedy assassination just kept it simple and in their refutations. But, you know what I mean? When you get in isolation, sometimes you can, you don't come up with the best answers. So the point being, the point being is this has got to get some fresh, clean air to it, I think, to continue to be relevant.
Yeah, Max Cleland, by the way, the name of that senator, but
right.
There's a bunch of other people. That's why I tried to keep it simple. All I talk about in the book is that the official story, what's wrong with the official story? We haven't even begun to scratch all the different ways in which it's completely impossible. You would think that they would come up with some plausible thing, but it's completely, it's as obvious as the fact that the top of the building can't crush the bottom if it doesn't land on it, you know? There's many things like that. So we just tried to focus on that and, you know, why speculate? You know, there needs to be an investigation, and in the investigation you'll figure out the answers to those questions. So I'm not a big fan of trying to, speculate about those things.
Yeah, well, there's so many things that need addressing in this country that the people feel have to be dealt with, and it's not. I mean, so I don't think, given the current political configurations, that this is going to go anywhere. So what would you suggest? I mean, a good starting point if people accept or even are questioning or want to be challenged, as we all should, would be to get this book, 9/11, The Simple Facts, Why the Official Story Can't Possibly Be True. My guest is Arthur Naiman, the author. So, what are folks to do?
Well, I think, you know, what, you can sign the petition that the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. But on pressure, I'm not going to vote for anybody who isn't in favor of opening a new investigation. And I think that Gravel's idea of having the states do it, I mean, there's no reason why a state can't investigate it, and the funding doesn't have to be. Even states are, of course, broke, but this wouldn't cost much money at all to support that. We have information about that in the book, too, that Gravel's call for an investigation at the state level. And several states can get together, of course, and chip in to make it happen. It's more likely to start there than at the federal level.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being on the broadcast. Arthur Naiman, N-A-I-M-A-N, has been my guest. He's written the book with Greg Roberts and the Architects and Engineers, 9/11 Truth for a World Trade Center, did the technical help with it. It's published by softskull.com. You can go to Amazon with most books. Also, I'll have a link on my site, peterwerby.com. Arthur Naiman, thanks for being on the broadcast.
My pleasure, Peter.
This is Night Call. On 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this. Detroit's Rock Station on the web. Thanks for listening to WRIF.com. Rockin' Detroit at 101.1 FM and the rest of the planet online at WRIF.com. back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. I think you know my abiding interest in history and the importance of it to understand what we're doing today and where we're going to go from today to tomorrow. And I don't think I've lived in a period as critical as this. Future looks kind of scary, and we always can depend, I think, in my estimation, of certain people that give us a good clue, not only of, for instance, what happened in the past, but give us an idea of how to read the future and the present for ourselves. One of those people was Howard Zinn. And Howard Zinn died at age 87 in January of 2010. If you're a longtime listener of this broadcast, you know I've interviewed him any number of times. And he was so prolific. And he not only did he have his huge People's History of the United States, 1492 to the present, which was first published in 1980 and updated any number of times, which has sold over 2 million copies. I mean, this is a history book, right? But his writings appeared in many different places. He was generous always with his time, and one of the repositories of his essays was in the Progressive magazine. I interviewed the editor, Matthew Rothschild, about 3 years ago during the 100th anniversary of the Progressive magazine. You can go to progressive.org. And Matthew Rothschild has the foreword in the historic Unfilled Promise, Howard Zinn's essays that appeared in the Progressive magazine. It's a pleasure to welcome back Matthew Rothschild at his office in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Matt.
Hey, Peter. Thanks for having me back on.
Yeah, you know, you say the foreword. I should have asked you this off the air. Did you also select these, or, and essentially is the are the editor of this volume as
no,
well?
No, I didn't edit it. My friends over at City Lights Publishing out in San Francisco edited it. We sent them all the essays that Howard Zinn wrote for the Progressive over the years, and he wrote for us steadily in the last 12 years of his life and wrote occasionally prior to that, but it was one of the great joys of my tenure here as editor, now coming on 20 years, working with Howard Zinn, who was a delightful man. I mean, you know, Peter, a lot of people with big reputations have even bigger egos, and that wasn't true of Howard Zinn, or at least he knew how to tuck his in, because he was just a delightful man. He had a great sense of humor, but, you know, the wisdom just pours forth from every page in this book. And it was fun for me just over the last 15 minutes to leaf through it again in preparation for our talk, because I hadn't gone over it for a while. And, there, you know, I think anyone who wants to introduce themselves or their kids to a really profound look at U.S. history and world history over the last 20 years should get this little paperback. It's so accessible, too. I mean, he writes real clearly, real comprehensively, and these are short essays, so you can read one a night before you go to bed without any trouble.
Yeah, it's kind of extraordinary, particularly a history book like A People's History of the United States, that at least probably a good number of people in the audience that have had to read history books probably would groan at the thought of having to read history. Yet everything he writes in that book is exciting. And what we're talking about in the Howard Zinn, the historic Unfilled Promise, looks at contemporary issues in many of them, right?
Yeah, he talks a lot about the Iraq War. He talks about the Afghanistan War. He talks about Obama. The unfulfilled promise, the historic unfulfilled promise that he talks about is, of course, democracy. He writes in the first essay here that we need to move toward the ideals of egalitarianism, community, and self-determination. And he called that whole concept democracy. So it's about democracy. It's about human rights for every single individual. It's about freedom, and it's about justice. So, and it also, you know, he wasn't a scowly leftist. You know, he wasn't someone who was always just screaming and yelling and raging at the world. I mean, he could rage sometimes, but he also told jokes, and he also really loved the arts. He loved the actors and the writers and the musicians and the poets, and he understood that they could reach people, and here maybe have been a bit of modesty on his part, that they could reach people more directly than himself writing an editorial or someone less gifted writing editorials like me. So that was also a dimension of his that was so nice to see, because a lot of times you can see political figures, whether they're on the left or the right, and one, they don't seem to have a funny bone in their body, and number two, they're just kind of tedious. And neither was the case with Howard Zinn.
Howard Zinn, the historic unfilled promise, unfulfilled promise, is the book we're talking about. It's published by City Lights Books, and I'm talking with Matthew Rothschild. He is the editor of the Progressive magazine, and you can go to progressive.org, find both of them, both the information about the magazine. The magazine is over 100 years old, and and also the information about the book is there as well. You were talking about his Howard Zinn's accessibility. I know the first time I ever talked to him, I thought, well, this guy is going to, I'm probably have to go through about three or four layers of his people. So I called this number, and this woman says, hello. And I went, oh, I'm sorry, I was looking for Howard Zinn. She said, oh, this is his house. This is Mrs. Zinn. And I said, well, I'd like to talk to him. And she says, Howard. And, you know, he came to the phone. And I said, wow. I said, you just have your phone number available like that? And he said, yeah. I said, don't you ever get weird calls, because he's reviled and despised by the right wing? And he said, oh, once in a while. But, you know, he didn't seem to care. I mean, he was just there for us, wasn't he?
He was just really down to earth. That was the wonderful thing about him. I remember when he gave a talk here, not only at our 100th anniversary celebration, but earlier on, and he was real tired at the end. He must have been at least 75 at that time, and people were just, you know, coming up to him after his talk and getting autographs and asking him questions, and he just lingered and lingered and lingered, which I thought was nuts. I was ready to act as a bodyguard and get him out of there, but no, he waited, and then at the very end, he wanted to go. I asked him for drinks, and he said, no, what I really wanted was a milkshake. So we just went over to the nearest ice cream place, and we've got good ice cream here in Madison, Wisconsin. And he went in the little shop and ordered a chocolate malt and kept signing people's papers who were in there. There were four or five customers, and three of them must have recognized him. So, but that's how he was. You know, he didn't have airs. He didn't think he was better than anybody else.
Yeah, yet an historian who people are seeking his autograph. That's very, very strange. Matthew Rothschild, when, like, all of these essays in the book, The Historic Unfulfilled Promise, which way would it go? Would he call you and say, hey, I gotta write something about this? Or did you call him and say, Howard, we need, which way did it go?
It went both ways. It was a real two-way street. So, for instance, when Kurt Vonnegut died, I instantly thought, well, Howard Zinn, Kurt Vonnegut, they're about the same age. They had experiences fighting in World War II. They both became pacifists, essentially. And I thought they must have known each other for years and years. So I asked Howard if he would write a column, a eulogy for Vonnegut. And as it turns out, he had only gotten to know Vonnegut in about the last 10 years of his life, but they had a great friendship and they did have so much in common. So that was one that he brought to us. But oftentimes he would be writing something. He'd email me and say, you know, take a look at this. If you don't think it's any good, of course, you don't need to publish it.
Yeah.
You know, that was him being humble, or at least fake humble. And I give points for both. You know, actually, I interviewed him once on radio, and I said, boy, you're either humble or you fake it real well. And he laughed and said, is that a compliment?
Yeah, he certainly would. You would almost not think he was an academic. I mean, both you and I know academics, and most of them are wonderful people. Most of them don't put on airs, but there was something about him, and maybe it was Howard Zinn's origins as coming from an immigrant family and, you know, working in industrial plants. And I mean, give us just a little thumbnail of Howard Zinn's personal history.
Yeah, I mean, he grew up in a real working-class family in New York. His father was a waiter, a waiter his whole life, and it really bothered Howard Zinn that the bosses who were running the restaurant or hotel where his father worked would treat him with such disdain, even though his father was excellent at what he did and worked real hard, and yet the class structure there, even in that restaurant and hotel, was imprinted on Howard early on, and so he was fighting that his whole life too. And, you know, he understood that it was important you know, to speak plainly to people. I know a lot of academics don't want to speak that plainly and want to show off their knowledge by using huge words or something. That wasn't a game that Howard Zinn played. He didn't want to play that Ivy League, here's my SAT verbal score game. You know, he wanted to reach as many people as possible. Mm-hmm. And that's a real political task. He wanted to tell people how he saw the world in hopes of improving the world. And so he didn't want to, it wasn't about him. It wasn't about Howard. It was about making the world a better place. And so if that's your mission, you don't want to, you know, draw attention to yourself and exclude others by talking in some obscure, pedantic language.
Yeah, that's why his book, A People's History of the United States, has sold over 2 million copies. He doesn't use, trope and a lead and discourse. And
right, and I think it's one of the reasons why some historians would try to put him down. One, they were jealous. I mean, who has ever published a history book, you know, that's sold one-tenth or one-hundredth of what A People's History of the United States has sold? So they were jealous about that. And so in the petty academic way, people would say, well, this is pop history or something. Well, don't you want people to understand what history is? So why don't you explain it to them in ways that they can understand?
You know, I was actually going to bring that up. I was, I could imagine. In fact, maybe we need a little clarity for our listeners as well, people that are not familiar with the people's history of the United States, that its historiography, how it approached the history of the United States. But I was almost shocked at the level of criticism that some historians have made of that 2 million seller book. Tell us just, you know, what his basic premise was for writing A People's History of the United States, and it shows up all through Howard Zinn, the historic unfulfilled promise as well.
Yeah, his whole orientation was not to write a history of presidents or of generals or of senators or any of the so-called important people in U.S. history. His orientation was to write a people's history, what people were doing, how people were fighting back. He understood that there was conflict at the very beginning, conflict when Columbus landed here. So his description of Columbus discovering America is quite different than you found in the history books when you and I were growing up, Peter. He talks about how the Indians were decimated, how Columbus and his people were terrorizing the Indians, and how the Indians were fighting back. He would talk about slave rebellions, and he would talk then, you know, Shays' Rebellion in 1789 after, or 1787, after the American Revolution, when farmers in western Massachusetts started to rebel because they were getting ripped off. And so he was always defending the people who were getting ripped off and being exploited, and especially highlighting those people who were fighting back. So that really is the whole framework of Howard Zinn's history and of his columns.
You know, I was looking at one of the criticisms, and this seemed so contradictory to the Howard Zinn that you, Matthew Rothschild, and I knew. It would say that, it says, a hatred of mankind is the dominant tone of Zinn's book. This comes from the historian Oscar Handlin, who was a big deal at Harvard. So he says that Howard Zinn hated mankind. That's the dominant tone of Zinn's book. I'm thinking, which book did he read?
I mean, it is amazing, isn't it? I mean, this is a conservative historian out of the ivyest of the Ivy Leagues condemning Howard Zinn, who was at Boston University, but before that was at Spelman College in the South, teaching Alice Walker. And some other people were very active in the civil rights movement, actually getting arrested down there in support of the civil rights movement. That's how courageous he was. But I can't think of any writer who loved people more than Howard Zinn did, so, and loved mankind. What he hated was exploitation. What he hated was bullying. You know, bullying is probably the basic, the reflex against bullying is probably the most basic democratic and progressive impulse that there is. And Howard Zinn had that impulse. You barely had to tap his knee and his leg would go out if he saw some bullying going on. And that he wrote against bullying. And to write against bullying is to love mankind, and that's what he did.
You know, you mentioned in passing that that both he, Howard Zinn, and Kurt Vonnegut had seen service in World War II, and yet had become pacifist. And he explains this, and I'm trying to put my mind together with which book of his sort of his memoirs that he talked about that. But how did this pacifism, or and was it really a pacifism? Did he believe in, you know, like ultimate pacifism? Or
no, it wasn't ultimate pacifism, Peter, but it was close. I mean, in his memoir that you were referring to, You Can't Be Neutral,
oh, right.
On a Moving Train,
right.
He talked about being an eager bombardier with the U.S. military in France in the waning days of World War II and dropping what was the functional equivalent of napalm on some villages there. And at the time, he wasn't horrified, but the more he thought about his experience, he was horrified about not only his role in war, but war, period, and then tried for the rest of his life to agitate for the abolition of war. And that's really what drove him. And I remember going to his memorial service and hearing his daughter talk about ending war being the most important thing in his whole life. I mean, there are plenty of issues here in this book and in people's history that he was devoted to, but that was uppermost in his mind. He wasn't totally a pacifist. He said there are some justifications for a very limited amount of force at particular times if they can prevent astronomical violence to come. But he didn't like what he called organized terrorism, which is war, full-fledged war, one nation against another.
The book is The Historic Unfilled I haven't said that right once. The Historic Unfulfilled Promise by Howard Zinn. It's essays that were collected from the Progressive magazine. My guest is Matthew Rothschild. He is the editor of the Progressive magazine. It goes back over 100 years of incredible history. And you can go to progressive.org. There'll also be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, .com. Let's get to the book. Now, you said that City Lights, a wonderful imprint, and I do lots of authors from that, citylights.com, they selected the essays from all the progressive columns that he had written in your magazine. The book's about 250 pages. Was there any that you said, ooh, I wish it was like 265 because there was one great one that got left out?
Oh, you know, I did. I just did because there was an essay he wrote in 2005 called The Scourge of Nationalism.
Huh.
The Scourge of Nationalism, in which he says people should put away their flags and not sing the anthems and move beyond patriotism, move beyond nationalism, and understand that we're all one people in this world and we all have equal rights and claims to freedom and equality and democracy in this world. So that was a real a lovely column, one of my favorites, and I was just thinking as I was going through the book, God, I wish I had begged the people at City Lights to put that one in too, but there was so much to draw on. You know, I don't blame editors typically since I am one.
Well, you know, Matthew, just as you said that, I bet you, speaking of flags, a lot of flags went, whoa, wait a minute, this guy does not want to honor the symbols of the United States of America, the flag, the national anthem. I mean, this guy really must be anti-American.
Well, I think this is one of the most challenging concepts that he put forward, this idea that we should question the need for patriotism or the accepted notion that we are the greatest country in the world or that the best country ever in the world. And this is something that isn't natural, but it is, you know, it is driven into us. It's something that's inculcated into us by our parents or by the schools or by the TV or by the government. And his view was that this patriotism can be toxic, that it can lead to nationalism, and the nationalism can lead governments to take us into illegal wars like George W. Bush did in Iraq, and it can lead to atrocities. And so it's a real cautionary tale, and I think it's a hard one for I would say probably 95% of Americans to grapple with. And I know my dad flew the American flag out front of his house his whole life. He was a World War II vet, and I know we didn't see eye to eye on this one, but I've come around to Howard Zinn's view on this, and I think we all, as thinking people, need to wrestle with ideas that are given to us. Do we accept those ideas? Are those ideas valid, Why are they valid? Maybe they're valid in some times and not valid in others, rather than just passively accept them. And he was never one to passively accept a received idea.
Well, let's do this. We have about 5 or 6 minutes remaining, and we've never really gotten into the content of Howard Zinn, the historic unfulfilled promise. And these are essays from the Progressive magazine. My guest is the editor of the magazine, Matthew Rothschild, and you can go to progressive.org for information on the book and on the magazine. And, hey, support print. Matt and I were talking about that before we started recording this, but that's another story. But take us through just a couple of these, and rather than randomly, tell, you know, and I think when you run a publication like I have in the past, it's okay to be proud of what you've done. And are there any specific ones in here that you are saying, damn, I'm proud to be associated with this magazine that could print this essay by Howard Zinn right at this time when it was so critical? Are there ones in there like that?
Sure, and I felt that way almost with every one. But, you know, there was an essay in here where he, and following up on the patriotism argument that we were just discussing, where he talked about U.S. soldiers who died in the Iraq War. He wrote they did not die for their country, and of course they were always told they were dying for their country, but he was brave enough to say they didn't die for their country, they died for their government. They died for Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld, and yes, they died for the greed of the oil cartels, for the expansion of the American empire, for the political ambitions of the president. They died to cover up the theft of the nation's wealth, to pay for the machines of death. To me, those are really challenging thoughts, too, because every time a president tells people to go to war, he says, you know, you're going to die for the country, you're not going to die in vain. And are they really dying for the country, or the people who are dying for the people who are sending them over there, or the people and forces behind the president and the generals who are sending them over? So that certainly was one of those essays that struck me as really hitting an important and controversial, but I think fundamental point. Another one was, and this is a theme that runs throughout Howard Zinn's writing, and that is that governments, even dictatorships, and power structures that are oppressive are more vulnerable than we think they are. And certainly this came through in the Arab Spring when we saw Hosni Mubarak and the dictatorship of Egypt fall, when we saw the Soviet Union collapse, when we saw the apartheid government collapse. I mean, these are amazing things that happen. When they happen, they surprise us. They didn't surprise Howard Zinn because he understood that governments are fragile. The power of government, whatever weapons it possesses, he wrote, whatever money it has at its disposal, he said, is fragile. When it loses its legitimacy in the eyes of its people, its days are numbered. And so he concluded, we need to engage in whatever nonviolent actions appeal to us. There is no act too small, no act too bold. The history of social change, he said, is the history of millions of actions, small and large, coming together at critical points to create a power that governments cannot suppress. To me, that is an inspiring message because too often people think, we can't do anything about it. We're powerless. It's always going to be this way. I might as well give up. And he rebutted each one of those claims. And to me, that gives us the inspiration we need to carry on and try to improve this country.
Howard Zinn seemed like a man who would always be with us. He lived to 87. He was very vigorous. In fact, he died while swimming in California in 2010. And he seems irreplaceable, which is, on one hand, is an incredible tribute to the man, but doesn't bode well for what we want to say, what the Progressive magazine wants to say. Are there people that, and I don't either names or just in general, people that can fill Howard Zinn's shoes?
Well, I think he would answer, and certainly I would answer, that he wouldn't want people to fill his shoes, and that there are millions of shoes out there that are being filled today that we should look at. And it's not necessarily someone who's on everybody's lips or who sells 2 million copies of a history book, but it's people who are out there marching on the picket lines, you know, whether it's against Palermo's Pizza in Milwaukee where there's a strike right now, or tomato pickers in Florida, or, you know, trying to protect people who are being foreclosed upon in Detroit. I mean, he would say those are the people whose shoes we need to notice. And so I think he's right about that. Too often, history is of, you know, the most famous, even the most famous people on the left. And that wasn't something that, interested him all that much.
Well, the book is an incredible collection of the essays of historian, the late Howard Zinn. The book is called The Historic Unfulfilled Promise. The foreword is by Matthew Rothschild, and he is the editor of the Progressive Magazine, the 100-year-old progressive, as it says, Progressive Magazine. You can go to progressive.org, and there'll be a link on my website as well, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. And it's published by City Lights. That's citylights.com. The Noam Chomsky has said, Howard Zinn's life and work are an unforgettable model, sure to leave a permanent stamp on how history is understood and how a decent and honorable life should be lived. It all comes clear in this book. Matthew Rothschild, thanks again for being on the on my program.
Peter, it's been my pleasure, and I look forward to it again.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit. Detroit's rock station rocks worldwide. You're listening to WRIF.com. This is 101 WRIF. Thanks for rocking with us online at WRIF.com.
You need to
Get all of Drew and Mike's best moments delivered right to your computer or mobile device. The Drew and Mike Podcast, brought to you by Matt's Jewelry Brokers. For fast cash, call Matt's at 586-286-2866. Subscribe today at WRIF.com. Getting you back to the rock.
Don't you tell me you're not alive.
101 WRIF.